then also a more mainstream audience, which is giving them extra sense of legitimacy.
That was journalist Justine Sharrock, author of the Mother Jones magazine article, Age of Treason. Read the article online at motherjones.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced in association with WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Hello. We are robots sent from outer space to replace the Devil Mix 3.
We are androids and we are strong.
101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz.
It's all my circuits pick up.
'Why not? Oh, there we go. Let's start again. This is Resistance and Renewal Radio on Free Radio Santa Cruz. My name's Louie, and tonight we're going to be talking to a couple of guests I have in the studio about South Africa. And one is, welcome to our show tonight.
Hi, my name's Nicholas Whitehead. I am a former white South African living in Santa Cruz the last 45 years. But I don't mind saying something in African language relating to struggle and resistance. It would be Mayebuye, which would be freedom, and then Mandla Ngowetu, which would be power to the people, slogan of the ANC.
Oh, okay, thank you.
And I'm here with Susan Russell, my lady friend.
And, yeah, Susan Russell, welcome, Susan.
Hi, we recently came back from a trip to South Africa, and we would like to share some of our experiences and observations while we were there.
Oh, please, yes, please. So let me start with you, Nicholas.
Yeah.
So you were born in England.
Born in England and left there at age 7.
Age 7, your family moved to
Johannesburg, South Africa.
To Johannesburg. And how did they happen to move there? What occasioned that?
Well, my father had always wanted to live in a sunny climate. He actually favored California, but at the time, South Africa was offering assisted passages to people with skills, and he had horticultural skills, so he could get money from the government of South Africa to go there, and then he worked and saved up money for the rest of the family to come over.
So he was in agriculture or gardening or?
Yeah, horticultural, small-scale vegetable growing and nursery work.
So 7 years old, you leave England and go to South Africa with your mother and father,
mm-hmm.
brothers and sisters?
Right. Just one brother, Jan.
Is Jan older or younger?
He's just a couple of years younger than me.
Okay, so he's 5
yeah.
at the time.
So we were raised there,
educated. And you went to Joburg, as they call it, Johannesburg?
Joburg, also known as Goli, the city of gold. The Africans called it Goli.
Oh.
Yeah.
And is that an Afrikaans word?
No, that's an African language word.
African language word. Okay.
Yeah.
So at the time, so what year was this when you arrived?
1947 or 8.
Okay, and how long did you live there?
We lived there about 20 years.
Till 19...
Well, no, not 20, 15, 16 years.
Till 63
yeah,
or so?
Yeah, about the time of President Kennedy.
Okay.
Just, yeah.
I'm sorry, you arrived in 1948, and that was, is that correct?
Yeah.
That was...
Good afternoon, and welcome to Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the heartland of Santa Cruz. It's that time again, and I'm Janaea. I'm your host, and with me is Thomas Miller. He's my co-host there.
Good afternoon, everyone.
We've got a great program. The first hour, we're going to be talking with Dr. Eldon Taylor, and he is fascinating. We're going to be learning about the power of the mind, unexplained events, and many other mysteries. And then we'll be talking with Catherine Albright, the author, co-author of Spy Chips, about the ways in which our rights, privacy rights, are being encroached, and alternative search engines that do not keep the information that we search for. Then the final hour, we're going to be learning about the corruption of the government in Brazil, and how it's impacting indigenous rights. But I believe we have Dr. Taylor on the air now. Dr. Taylor, are you with us?
I am. Thank you very much for the opportunity to share.
Oh, thank you for coming on. I've really enjoyed your books tremendously. And I just want to give a little brief introduction to our listeners about who you are. Dr. Eldon Taylor, he's basically been researching the human mind for over 25 years and is considered an expert in hypnosis and subliminal communication, which he is, particularly after reading your book. And he's a fellow with the American Psychotherapy Association and also a non-denominational minister. And he was a practicing criminologist for, 10 years? Is that correct? And he's the author of the New York Times bestseller Choices and Illusions, and then Mind Programming from Persuasion and Brainwashing. And most recently, What Does That Mean? Exploring Mind, Meaning, and Mysteries. Before we begin, I just want to say a little bit about it. Truly, with each chapter, I went in more deeply to the mystery of who I am, and I was amazed. Basically, it's a deeply satisfying and divinely inspiring book that goes into a lot of our inconsistencies, the paradoxes that we live with, the beliefs that we hold. That's pretty much what I'm going to say now. I'm going to let you get started here. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And hello, Thomas.
Hey, hello, Doctor.
Well, call me Eldon, please.
Eldon, okay, Eldon. That's good for me.
I'd like to begin by asking you, what possessed you to start exploring the mind and your passion for the mind?
There goes the whole hour.
Oops. Oh, no, I have a lot of other questions here. You definitely have to come back.
I know. You know, I, like most people, I believe, you know, when I was very young, I wanted to know why people did things. It was quite obvious, and I think is quite obvious to most children, that, you know, you get mixed messages from adults. You get mixed messages from the so-called authority. And you see them do what they tell you they won't do. And so there was this great, you know, questioning that went on in me when I was very, very young. But more specifically, when I found myself practicing criminalistics, running lie detection examinations, I could sit across from, you know, somebody that was 6'6" and 285 pounds that had played lineman for, you know, a football team, and watch them cry like a baby when they confessed a crime that they did. And I would ask myself very often, you know, why on earth would you tell me what you did? I mean, why would you confess? Why would you admit it? But then, why did you do it in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
Now, we always hear stories. You know, I did it. And one of the classics in my mind is a story that a young man told me why he had stolen from an employer thousands of dollars worth of lumber, as it turned out, lumber and building materials. And his reason was basically this. You know, I put in a lot of work. My employer doesn't appreciate me. He underpays me. I had a new baby at home. We needed a room for the baby. I thought, well, a little bit of this won't hurt. I could finish a room in the basement. I was just trying to be a good father, and on and on. In that, you see all kinds of rationalizations for the justification behind this behavior. So, you know, my interest grew initially out of just trying to match people's motives with their actions.
Mm-hmm.
And as time passed, I began to see that, you know, the bottom line is most of them aren't aware of the differences that are within them. I mean, the inconsistencies, the cognitive constructs that they hold that are mutually exclusive, that which we term as cognitive dissonance in behavioral science. And so what I tried to do in my first book, Choices and Illusions, we show how, as Krishnamurti said, you know, choice is an illusion. Do I do this? Do I do that? Arises as a result of confusion.
Mm-hmm.
If I know clearly what to do, there is no confusion. But we have been taught in a rather rote core way, all the way through our system,
mm-hmm.
to look for our alternatives. So we, you know, we have a multiple choice, and it's A, B, C as our alternatives. And we don't stop to understand that there's an entire alphabet out there of choices. The result is we can't possibly think out of the box unless that thinking is the thinking that's been given to us. We live within a proscribed parameter.
Mm-hmm.
We operate on automatic.
Mm-hmm.
And the entire notion of mindfulness
mm-hmm.
is gone.
Mindlessness, it's more.
Yeah. Well, and you know, you and I were saying before we went on the air, you can go to third world countries, you can see what goes on in these third world countries, and understand that the people in those countries do get it. They do know that they're being manipulated. They do know what's being done to them. They're
mm-hmm.
not happy about it.
Mm-hmm.
But you can come to America, you can see a VNR, a video news release, that was designed to be a VNR released in a foreign country, play here in the United States, and that piece of propaganda is taken as though this was the latest news.
Yeah.
And we're oblivious to it. We're just totally oblivious to it.
Yeah, the enculturation is so deep, we're not taught anymore. I feel that the educational system is at fault to an extent, and the media. I mean, it's all pervasive, the whole enculturalization.
I'll tell you what.
As intense when I was younger. I was taught to think more critically.
Well, I don't know about that.
The school system.
You had an exceptional school because our educational systems are not designed to educate.
I think.
If you go right back to the charters, the founding examples of our educational system, it's copied after a Prussian model from 1812, and it's actually designed to socialize. And by socialize, that means teach you to believe the kinds of things that you should believe because these are the good things for society. So, you know, people become really outraged and upset when they hear about, you know, let me tell you, I'll just give you a quick one. The University of Delaware has
mm-hmm.
a policy that if you live on that campus, okay, stay in one of the dorms on that campus, and you happen to be white, you're born white, you must admit that you're a racist, okay?
What?
Quote, the term applies to all white people, i.e., people of European descent, living in the United States. Now, I'm quoting this. Regardless of class, gender, religion, culture, or sexuality, by this definition, people of color cannot be racist because as peoples within the U.S. system, they do not have the power to back up their prejudices, hostilities, or acts of discrimination. Now, this policy, they call re-education. You know, this is an ideological re-education called reverse racism.
No. It certainly
is. This is a university. This is a state-funded, federally backed, you can borrow money, university. There's no reason for a policy of that nature in a university. Not in my book.
Well, it's not true, for one thing.
I know it.
No,
a lot isn't that's being propagated, though.
That also is true.
No, I understand what you're saying, and maybe I'm deluding myself into thinking that I had a fairly decent education.
Well, and when you think about it, you know, think about this. Were you taught that, who invented the light bulb? Thomas Edison?
Oh, yes, and I know it
wasn't.
Yeah,
well, Edison didn't invent the light bulb.
I learned later.
You know?
Who invented the light bulb?
He had a lot of PR.
Who invented the light bulb?
That is pure PR.
Hmm.
The Edison came as a result of Bernays, who is the father of modern propaganda, if you will, and I detail all this in my book, Mind Program.
Yes, I remember.
It's the Golden Lights Jubilee, and he wanted to celebrate. I mean, they wanted to sell light bulbs, what it came down to. So he had to have a local, you know, and Thomas Edison, he made the inventor, when indeed the inventor was a British citizen, a man by the name of Joseph Swan. We have more examples of that, though.
Yeah.
We have a founder of a university who's taking some flack because this is the first non-religiously affiliated university in the country, and so he writes a textbook, and the textbook becomes a history book, and today historians look at it and think that it's a perfect model of a history book that belongs in a museum for how not to write a history book, because this book is just full of lies and myths. But hey, you go to a school today and you say, did the world think that it was flat, that the earth was flat when Columbus made his voyage?
Mm-hmm.
No, I'll tell you, yes. Your teachers are telling you that.
That's
well, the fact
what we're
is,
taught.
That's not true. We know 500 years before Christ that the Greeks calculated the circumference of the earth within just a couple of hundred miles. The knowledge wasn't lost. It wasn't forgotten. And you can say to the same teacher, are you aware of? And they say, oh, yeah, I never thought of that. They're holding two different beliefs at the same time.
And the beliefs determine who we are, our sense of identity, how we exist in the world. And you write extensively about the fact that we don't have any original thoughts and how we're continually being consumed as consumers.
That's 100% right. I mean, the bottom line is we have been trained how to think.
Exactly.
So, everything is within a context, and everything follows a given suit. We know that one and one is two, and when you show somebody to add a gallon of alcohol to a gallon of water does not equal two, it shocks them. It absolutely shocks them. They
yes.
never thought that there is an alternative, that one and one equals two only within a system. We get tied into our context of thinking. So somebody knocks on your door at 9 o'clock at night, and they say to you, I'm in a scavenger hunt. If you've got a 3x7 piece of wood, I can win $10,000 and I'll split it with you. And you think, I don't have a wood pile. Gee, I'm sorry, Charlie. And you close your 3x7 wood door. We don't even think on the edge. I mean, and then we get blinded. Let me give you a quick example. It's one of my favorites. Think of the saliva in your mouth right now. And all your listening audience out there, think of the saliva in your mouth.
Okay.
Roll it around, taste it. Appreciate it because you're glad you have it. You know what a dry mouth is like. You know what it's like to wake up in the middle of the night and just have to have a drink because your mouth is parched.
Yes.
So, you know, taste it, enjoy it. Now I want you to imagine that you just have a small shot glass and you're going to spit that saliva into that shot glass.
There it goes.
Look at it and now drink it back. And the minute I say drink it back, everybody goes, oh! But why? It's exactly the same saliva that was in my mouth. Separated by just, you know what, a second, 2 seconds?
Yeah.
We hold things in context and we're blinded by it. So, you know, the saliva is great in one context, but in another context, it's just totally, you know, horrible. You know, sometimes it's humorous. Most people, most Americans saw Susan Boyle. UK's Got Talent. This disheveled woman comes out on the stage.
Scottish
looks
woman.
Like Susie Homemaker has been dropped off in the Juno Desert, then drug across it. She, you know, bless her heart, was just
but
not.
What a beautiful singer.
When she opened her mouth, it was mellifluous. But everybody's laughing. Everybody is, you know, mocking it. They're rolling their eyes. And the question is, why? What is there in your head that makes you think a singer should look a certain way?
Mm-hmm.
We call these things implicit biases. To me, the classic example is Jesse Jackson. Reverend Jackson admits that he's coming back to his hotel one evening after a presentation that he's given. It's late. He's alone. It's dark. He hears some heavy, rapidly approaching footsteps from behind. He turns quickly, startled. He's relieved when he sees it's a white man.
Yeah.
Now you think
the
about
deep deep.
How embarrassing that can be. But these are deeply impressed,
yes,
implicit biases, and they all operate behind the scenes. Now, here's the real kicker, you know. The people in the know, they know exactly every button to push. You know, smokers always talking about kicking the habit.
Now, when you
we have
say
a new study out of the United Kingdom, it's not new now, it's a couple of years old, using functional MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, we watched the nucleus caudate, an area in the brain that is associated with a reward center. Okay, this is the reward center. Light up, to use the words of fMRI, light up when we show you the Surgeon General's warning. In other words, you see the Surgeon General's warning, and it makes you want to smoke more. So what do the tobacco companies do? Well, look at a pack of cigarettes and make it larger. The state of sophistication that exists in knowing how to sell people ideas, to mm-hmm. sell them thoughts, to give them the very choices that they make. You know, am I on the Republican side or am I on the Democrat side? Do I oppose this or do I support this? These kinds of whole examples, they're false to the way our real choices should work.
I was a bit frightened after reading Mind Programming, actually, because you delineated so many ways that we are controlled. And I thought when I picked up the book, oh, no, I'm sure I make conscious decisions. But you also went into our subconscious and our genes, our DNA, and the fact that we really, to stay mindful, it's only, what, 40 or 50% of our capacity to be mindful? Did I?
Well, it would be wonderful if we could get that much mindfulness.
Well, potentially.
Well, I mean, potentially it is a great deal. You know, it's amazing, again, the reason I wrote Mind Programming, and, you know, I know the first half of the book is kind of dark, and it does frighten a lot of people. I mean, after all, you get somebody like Jules Romaine from the CIA testifying in
yeah.
a now declassified document to, you know, Congress, that utilizing their techniques and their explorations through their various clandestine studies
to create a nation of
zombies, that they can take a young person and make him kill his aged parents and cook them in a stew and eat them. I mean, that's pretty disgusting.
Yes.
This is testimony from our CIA as a result of years of research and just, you know, what we can do with pharmacology, with subliminal, with hypnosis, with, you know, different forms of psychological techniques that take people out of their environments and place them into other environments and create synthetic memories and so on and so forth. Very sophisticated work. But so that first half does scare you. You
yeah.
see who,
just
what,
a bit.
Where, when, and why. And when these advertisers say, hey, we never use subliminal anything,
uh-huh.
I give you the, if you will, the smoking gun. Here's their training manual. Here are the actual ads, and most people have seen these ads because there were huge ads, as you know from reading the book, appeared throughout the world. And this is why this material is in the ad. Here, this is how they teach an artist, their artists, their conceptual
oh,
people, their advertising
in
people to do it. And it is so sophisticated. You know, I have a psychologist friend that lives about 100 miles from me, and I sent him a copy of it when I got it. And he called me on the phone, and he said, Eldon, do you understand all this? This is very sophisticated. I mean, this is a trained, licensed psychologist. That he's like, and the irony of this is a lot of the research has been done since the birth of this kind of marketing, and today it's just known as neuromarketing research. It's mm-hmm. not available to the public. It's privately held information. Because it's not peer-reviewed, it's not public, you know, it's not made available for publication. So when you really get through it, and you're all said and done with the first half of the book,
I
had to write the second
half. I persevered.
Before you go on to the second half.
And the second half is how you undo it all, how you take the steps to avoid it. But, you know, I was talking just yesterday to a group of people, and one of the people in the audience said, well, you know, I just can't give up TV.
Oh, boy.
And I said, You know, are you aware that the average adult, and researchers have known this since 1956, sit down in front of a television set, and in less than 3 minutes, they'll go into alpha. Now, alpha is a state, a brainwave state associated with hypnosis. I mean, I've testified in courts of law as an expert on hypnosis in homicide cases. And hypnosis is, for all intent and purposes, only what we call a state of hyper-suggestibility. So, okay, you're in front of the television set, you're in this hyper-suggestible state, and here comes a selling sickness commercial. You know, the Gomboo's coming to town. Don't worry, when you get it, run down to the local drugstore and get ABC. It's going to fix you up. Now, we know that this kind of information is acted upon. I mean, it's taken in like a hypnotic suggestion. Mm-hmm. In fact, a great example of that is restless leg syndrome. 4 years ago, about, they rolled out, the owner of the drug patent rolled out a series of commercials nationwide on restless leg syndrome. It was all over television. I'm sure you saw them. Everybody
saw them. I did.
If you look at the American Medical Association data, the reports of restless leg syndrome, if we created a draft or a drawing, are coming along on a baseline equal to the baseline. I mean, there are none for all intent and purposes. Suddenly, with these commercials, we have a synodial function, a straight line raising into the air. Well, what happened was, of course, the drug company's patent expired, and so the commercials came off of television. And what happened to the reports of restless leg syndrome? They fell right back into that baseline again.
So, in other words, how do you
create it? And we have all kinds of examples. I mean, one of the classics is a schoolhouse where a school teacher finds a drum in the basement, stumbles on a drum in the basement that she accidentally spills, tips over, and this drum is full of a liquid. But on the drum is some, you know, old World War II-like stencil. She panics. She runs upstairs. She knows this has got to be some kind of chemical, from chemical warfare, etc. She begins to have symptoms, break out in hives, rash, temperature increase, etc. The word goes out that there is this chemical in the basement in the school. Yeah. Half the school is in the hospital by 6 o'clock that evening with all those symptoms, physical symptoms you can see, bumps, hives, and it was water.
Oh, my.
Water.
The suggestibility.
So we have case after case after case of that. But
what can we
with that
do?
Going on, with an individual knowing that, do you think, I mean, in this instance I'm telling you about, do you think that they're going to walk away from their television set?
No.
No, the answer is no.
People still don't, even with the awareness.
That's why I come back and say to you, that's the dangerous part of what's going on in America. We don't own our own thoughts. We don't own our own ambitions. We're no longer authentic people. You know, for all intent and purposes, we're being spoon-fed.
Well, that brings to mind a situation happened for my daughter and myself. We were flying across country, and we were in an airport in middle America. And all the TV monitors, they were talking about the bind, torture, and kill, the BTK mass serial killer had just been apprehended. And this was just, you know, an undulating throughout the airport. And I went up to one of the flight attendant people or desk people and said, hey, I don't want my daughter hearing this. She's 5 years old. There's no reason for her to have to hear this stuff. Can you turn the TV off where we're sitting? And she said, I'm sorry, I can't. But there is one place in the airport that you can go, and there's no TV. And it was probably about, it was a huge airport. It must have been literally about a half a mile away. It was upstairs, and there was no TV. It was the only place the whole rest of the airport, over and over and over again, bind, torture, kill, bind, torture, kill. And it's like, why, and
did
why don't people turn their, why don't people turn their TVs off? I don't own a TV.
I don't watch it. I have one.
Do you ever look at that and say, George Orwell? I mean.
So, Dr. Taylor Eldon, what recommendations do you have for us to stay awake?
Well, you know, the very first one And that's why I wrote my newest book.
And
what
I love
does that
it.
Mean?
Yes.
But the very first one is, you have got to find yourself. Now, this may sound like an old, old adage, you know, but there is a huge, as the Sufis say, a huge difference between the container and the content. If you stand in front of the mirror and you comb your hair and notice new wrinkles or do whatever you do, and identify that you are that physical body, well, you have bought the entire storyline. If that's who you are, you know, you're like an old
level.
Car.
On
when
some
you discover
level.
When you discover the dents and the dings in the old car, you're going to want to trade it in, or you're going to want to run get some Botox or some cosmetic surgery or some other thing, because you have bought the storyline. What is the storyline? Well, the last thing we want you to do is be authentic, because if you're authentic, you're going to ask those penetrating questions,
mm-hmm.
the kinds of questions that our country was founded on. I had a conversation this morning with a young woman, a radio host, by the way, who essentially was, you know, indicating that, you know, America has always been a land where anyone could do everything, a kind of cultural relative place to live. Okay? Mm-hmm. And I challenge that. You see, as far as I'm concerned, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that's an idea. This country was created on that idea. Pursuit of happiness does not mean I sit back on my sofa and people bring happiness to me. It doesn't mean everything in my society is disposable. It doesn't mean government does it for me, or my neighbor does it for me, or the plumber does it for me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I was a boy, I can remember, you know, reading Emerson's treatise on self-reliance.
Yes.
The rugged individualist. You know, what America was founded on first was a value system. I challenge people today to tell me where that value system is.
Can you say a little bit more about that?
Well, sure. It's like this. You know, I had on my own radio show Neil Donald Walsh not long ago. He's a very famous author of Conversations with God. Sold millions of copies of this. And I asked Neil, I said, tell me about virtue, you know. What would you say is the first virtue? And Neil said to me, there's no such thing as a virtue. I beg your pardon? Well, there's no such thing. It's culturally relative. You know, I mean, listen, if you happen to grow up in a culture where you're taught that jihad is the right thing to do, well, then jihad is the right thing to do. If you grow up in a culture where, no, hold it, wait a minute. As far as I'm concerned, I go back to the Platonic school.
Mm-hmm.
If there is no value that we can hold out to be sacrosanct anywhere and everywhere, then the world has no hope for peace, ever.
And really there's no purpose, because I feel that we are wired to feel our heart and the connections.
And you're absolutely right. I mean, the hard research, you know, it tells us that you are absolutely right. You can write a check to your favorite charity, and the brain becomes excited. That same reward center puts all those good neurochemicals onto your body. You can go to the aid. In fact, Gerald Jampolsky and his attitudinal centers in Tiburon, California, has documented this. Dr. Jampolsky can have a patient that is in incontractable pain, terminally ill, in the hospice facility, and that patient will go to the aid of another patient in dire need, and during that period of time, feel no pain.
Wow.
We are indeed wired for service, if you will.
Yes.
I mean, that is our highest, best reward. I call it the warm, fuzzy feeling. When you do something that helps another individual, you put your head on the pillow at night, you think about, reflect on that, that's when you know your life has made a difference. That's when you begin to, you know, okay, but we live in a society today that has become just totally consumption-oriented. when I studied psychology, they talked about four drives. And I had a professor, Professor Carl Lepresch, very famous man because of his research, actual implants, electrical implants in cats. No calls or nasty emails, please. I didn't do that. I didn't put electrodes in cats. He did. I was just right?
You probably couldn't, knowing you.
Well, you're probably right about that. But at any rate, what Carl used to say is, look, the basic drives are the four F's. There's fight, flight, feeding, and fornication. Okay?
Yes.
Now, I look at that, and I say today, there's a fifth drive. The fifth drive is more. I want more. I want more power. I want more money.
Yes.
I want more leisure. I want more. I want more.
Yeah. Well, I think that's our socialization, to want that, and it goes against our grain, so we're constantly feeling tense, like your head is in one place and your torso is in the other. I often feel like that, and I think I'm beyond that. I don't experience it, but I certainly do. I take a bus, and when I get on, I feel like a plebeian. And that's the socialization. I shouldn't be. I should be driving a car. And I wouldn't want to have it, or a Mercedes. I wouldn't want that. But there is a subtle underlying, image that is all around us and is portrayed.
Yeah, it's more emulated. Our socialization. It's actually, in my book, you know, we are soul. From the moment we open our eyes to the moment we close them and they put our ashes away or they seal us in a casket, we are being sold continually.
Yes, sold, purchased.
And I mean, there is somebody selling us something. They're selling us religion. They're selling us our dreams, our ambitions, the way we walk, how we talk. You know, as young people, we take our icons typically out of the media. And then we practice these scripts. You know, boys might stand in front of the mirror, you know, go ahead and make my day. We see bumper stickers that say, I don't get even, I get evener. You know, the body weight that we think we should carry, the kind of car we think we should drive, the kind of home we'd like to live in, all of these things, all of these images.
And I
want to
go.
The images that have been voiced upon us through the media, through the advertising, through the sales game, and they have become who we are and what we want because we've actually practiced them until they have become automatic.
And I want to go back to what you just stated about to get evener, more even. It's creating a more violent culture.
Never been a time in history when getting even was justified. I mean, even when there's a great samurai warrior story about the samurai warrior sworn to protect his king, and when he fails, he seeks vengeance, if you will. He seeks to carry out his duty, and when he finally gets to that point where it's in the dark of the night, and he has his sword, and the man is laying in bed, and he's able to exact that punishment.
Yes.
He can't. And the reason he can't is because it's a violation of his oath. His oath does not allow him to carry out revenge. It doesn't allow him to get even. He uses his might, he uses his strength to protect the innocent.
Mm-hmm.
No. So there's never really been a time in history that getting even or vengeance was truly justified. We look on that and think of it as being a base aspect of, and yet at the same time, if we come back and you take this cultural relative perspective, everything goes.
Oh.
Well, then in a society where that goes, it goes. But I started to say here's the problem that we get to in our own culture, because hopefully we don't have too many people actually practicing or thinking that it's great to commit such acts. But with that said, what we do have is such a division, such a diversity in our value system, such a dissonance in the information flow that has come to us, that we can find ourselves in double blind. Let me give you an example. Double bind, not blind. Let's assume you lived in the state of California. In the state of California, late-term abortion is legal. Now, not long ago, in one of the southern states, there was actually an instance where a child was born, but the umbilical cord was still attached, so the mother strangled the child because she did not want the child, and that was perfectly legal because the child was not yet independent. It was still dependent upon her. Now, this case happened just in the last 6 months, right? But so in the state of California, late-term abortion is totally legal, okay? Now, I'm not making a statement about abortion. Please understand that. I'm not trying to say it's good, it's bad, it's indifferent.
You're just showing the inconsistencies. Yes.
That's right. Also in the state of California, if you kill a pregnant woman, and she can only be pregnant by 3 weeks, say, she just left the physician and he just confirmed she was pregnant. And that's a double homicide. Now, wait a minute. How can I be charged with a double homicide for killing an unborn child in the womb of a woman when it's okay to just flush the damn thing down the drain first? Now, forgive me when I use that metaphor, but that's designed intentionally to be a powerful way for you to look at this and say, whoops, hold it. What is it I'm thinking here?
Where are you standing and why?
Yeah.
What do you really feel?
You know,
if you even recognize the inconsistency.
That's right. That's right. And if you don't recognize the inconsistencies, then who are you?
What's your purpose?
What do you think you believe? Why do you think you believe it? See, that's the thing. That's why I wanted to write what does that mean? I want people to stop and get authentic, to look at themselves, because I know inside every human being is a marvelous story and a marvelous opportunity. But that state, that wonderment, that place where you can just know happiness and know joy is forgotten, it's lost when you're in this caricature of who you ought to be, doing what you ought to do according to what's been sold to you.
Well, I think people are almost afraid to ask questions and go a little bit more deeper. It really upsets their identity. And I remember just reading your book, one chapter after another, I found myself hesitant to really explore what you were asking. You were talking about, well, the ego. Thomas was thinking about that too, and the balance that it plays in our lives. You explained that beautifully, and I'm doing a practice where I'm trying to not disempower the ego, but to diminish its authority, so to speak, and be more humble. And being a Leo, it's a challenge. And I love the way you talked about the balance, Juan.
You spoke about Eckhart Tolle's work in Buddhist nihilism, and how I just see the ego as a useful tool for navigating through the world of culture, and also a tool that can be misused when one's source of identity is solely focused on the ego's expression. I believe that there's beyond all the cultural models that are on the planet, there is the realm of the mystic or an arena of truth that everyone can tap into. Therefore, we're not enslaved by the cultural programming we get, or potentially we can free ourselves from that. And that's how I see your book as more of a wake-up call. Question these things that you've come up with and think about what you're believing. Not just believe it.
Well, thanks, Thomas. I mean, you said that very, very well. I do think that, we get caught up nowadays in this whole idea of the abolition of the ego, when indeed we need a healthy ego. That's exactly what we need. The notion that maybe the Dalai Lama doesn't have an ego is nonsense. The notion that Gautama Buddha didn't have an ego, or Martin Luther King doesn't have Mother Teresa. An ego is my self-identification. It knows who I am, mm-hmm. and it knows what I'm here for, and it knows what I want to do. A genuine mm-hmm. ego, the ego construct itself, you know, that's a Freudian notion that comes from the whole idea of psychodynamics and psychotherapy. If we view the mind, the subconscious, particularly as Freud did in his stratification, we have on one end the id, and the id has all of its basic libidinal drives, and those drives, they're instinctual, and it hungers for them, and it pushes us towards them. And over here on the other hand, we have the superego, and the superego is, you know, this is the divine parent that tells us how perfect we should be, could be, and are. And in order to balance these two poles that are constantly at our psyche, we have the ego. Mm-hmm. So the ego takes these base drives from the id and finds a sublimation point, mm-hmm. a socially acceptable way to act out that drive. So we're not having sex on the street like dogs. We have institutions like marriage. When you think about what made this country great, you have some pretty strong egos. You mm-hmm. don't have a nihilism kind of approach that, you know, I'm going to lose my identification and merge into some nothingness. And that was my issue with a lot of what goes on in contemporary thinking about how we attack the ego. You said it perfectly. What we want is a balanced, mm-hmm. healthy ego. We try to give our children positive self-esteem messages so that they will have a strong, balanced, positive ego. We're not trying, you know, to make egocentric people out of them, just healthy people that know who they are and can behave accordingly. And, you know, something you said, Cynthia, reminds me of years and years, you know, this is going back pre-Socrates, about 300 years before Socrates, we had this man Pythagoras, the great geometrist, mathematician, mm-hmm. and mystic. Mm-hmm. And he had a school, the Great Brotherhood. And then in the school, in order to be able to join the school, and first of all, you had to be 40. It was deemed that you had to be 40 and before you were old enough. But now I'm going to throw something else in there. 40, you know, the word is mem. You wandered in the wilderness for mem days, lost in the desert for mm-hmm. mem years. Mem really means completion. So whatever. Anyhow, you had to come to this stage where you were mature enough to enter the school. Then there was a test in order to be able to stay in the school. Mm-hmm. You would be sent into the desert. You would be told, well, we want you to think about all that you know and come back and tell us one thing that you're absolutely certain of. Just one thing. So you could stay in the desert as long as you wanted. When you had that one thing, you came back to the school, and they assembled the school, and there in like an amphitheater, all the students, Pythagoras himself, you presented that one thing. Mm-hmm. This is what I know to be true.
Okay.
And, of course, what did they do? On cue, they attacked you. They attacked the idea. They laughed at it. They made jokes about it. They belittled it. Because if you gave up your truth,
mm-hmm.
you weren't prepared to be a student in that academy. Okay?
Yeah.
So when you
it's see what you stand on.
People today, and you suggested this, you know, you're... It takes a daring individual
mm-hmm.
to say, now hold it. This is what I believe. This is how it is. This is how I derived this belief. And to go about that like we might, as Thomas said, like that mystic might have done in the days of Pythagoras.
Yeah, and
we have too few of those kinds of people today.
And mm-hmm. the balance, or a balance to an ego, is that truism that all is one, so that when that can keep the ego in check, that if you wouldn't want to do harm to anyone else or create bad situation because that other is actually you. So having that as sort of the overlay, then the ego can have a place to express itself without getting out of control or becoming egocentric,
that
as
awareness.
You said early.
It's a check.
Zero divided by zero, so very well said.
It's a good check. And part of that standing for what you believe, truly believe, and know from experience as well, and boy, your experiences have been quite amazing. You talk a lot about self-responsibility and blame, not blaming others, being responsible for what's happening to you in your lives, looking for the signs and the clues.
I learned that a long time ago. That was a real turning point in my career. You know, carrying a gun, conducting lie detection tests, running investigations, and a friend of mine knows that I'm doing some research that today we call InnerTalk, a technology that I patented, that it's a kind of dichotic masking, and I'm using this in my lie detection practice to eliminate inconclusive. A number of other agencies were using it for a long time, too, until the county attorney advised us it wasn't a good idea without informed consent. But and that is what we generally think of today as subliminal, okay? But this friend of mine said to me, he works at the Utah State Prison, a social worker said to me, you know, if this technology works this well, do you think we could use it at the prison to lower hostility and aggression, maybe, you know, to help rehabilitate these inmates? I ended up going out to the prison system. We ran some very heavy-duty psychometrics. They didn't tell us anything we didn't know. But when you visited with these inmates, what you could see was, ah, but for the grace of God, there go you. We heard stories like, you know, hey, if you'd have been me, you'd have done the same thing, man. I mean, my daddy was an alcoholic, my mommy a prostitute, and the neighbor boy mainlined me when I was 8 years old. Most of these stories were exaggerated, but even when they weren't, you could have two brothers from the same family, and one went off to be a surgeon, and the other was in the penitentiary for life. When we tried to work out an intervention, it became clear to me that the only way you were ever going to stand a chance to rehabilitate these people was to get them to take responsibility for everything they've done. Mm-hmm. Everything they've done. Mm-hmm. Okay, now, yeah, I mean, look, you're not in charge of the stimuli that flies at you, everything that comes to you, but you are in charge of your reaction to it.
Mm-hmm.
And you do have the ability to redefine that. Somebody cuts you off in 5 o'clock traffic, you can get angry, honk a horn, shake your fist, go into road rage, pull your gun out of the glove box, etc. But if you think instead, maybe they cut in front of you because they have a small child in the back seat bleeding and they're in a hurry to the hospital, all of a sudden, everything changes. The whole context changes. So you do have the power to just switch these contexts in your head and make entirely different choices. Well, what we did at the prison system was create a set of affirmations that to this day are free, and your listening audience can go get them at my website, a subliminal program at eldentaylor.com for giving and letting go, MP3, absolutely free. Download it all day long. Give it to your friends. Pass it out, because what I've learned, whether it's working with Fortune 500 athletes, and had the great opportunity to work with our Barcelona Olympic judo team, or with the Fortune 500 executives, the truck driver on the street, the people in a hospice center, it works in all these environments. If you take responsibility for everything you do in your life, you have nobody to blame.
And that alleviates a lot of the anger.
The way to do that is forgiveness. I forgive myself. I forgive all others. I am forgiven. Now, you do that, and now you can't blame it. And that means it's no longer what my daddy did, what my mommy said, what my wife did, what the police officer with a radar gun did. It's me.
And that frees up.
And if I want to change something, it's me, I change. You know, I'm the common denominator here.
And that frees up space for truly free choice and free will.
It does.
You're well, not running around with the old patterns. They aren't as evident.
The free will, I hesitate on only to say this. You know, that's a major controversy in universities around the country today, and the reason for that is hard research shows us that there's activity in the unconscious, milliseconds before the conscious, and that activity tells us, dictates muscle movement, what we're going to say, what we're going to do, etc. So you really have, as a neurosurgeon friend of mine in Hilo says, you have this very narrow window of opportunity for free will. It's a millisecond or so. I'm going to say that's false. I argue with him about it all the time. Because the brain is analogous in ways to a computer. If you'll change the content of what's in your mind, then what is given to you out of the subconscious as your choice possibilities becomes entirely different. So in that way, you do have free will. But the free will is, I have to program the computer to give me the opportunity to make those choices first. I
great
don't
point.
Get the free will in 2020 hindsight because I filled the computer with garbage in.
Television commercials.
Hey, Eldon, would you would you talk a little
turn
bit
on your radio?
Would you talk about this paragraph a little bit? It's in your book. It's, if I live truly from the spirit and therefore not from the world, I should transcend the so-called evils that somehow still seem to have claimed the lives of so many great and wise leaders of the past from all traditions, including Jesus of Nazareth. But since that doesn't appear to be the case, evil does not disappear, is there really any reason to believe that this world would still exist without its opposites? Is this only wishful thinking to believe so? Even so, is it still not worth striving for? What does that say about us, and what does that mean? I like the bit about living from spirit, regardless of the outcome. And is that what you do?
That's exactly what I try to do, Thomas. I would like to say to you yes unequivocally, but I still find myself with knee-jerk reactions. I've got a 16-year-old boy that knows every button to push on me sometimes. But I do try to do that. I wake up every morning and I suggest everybody begins a spiritual practice this way. And I've taught cops and everyone else to do this. So this is not New Age hocus pocus. You start your day with just a simple thank you. Okay? I wake up in the morning and I say thank you, thank you, thank you. You know, I'm here. I have another day. I have another opportunity. I realize that, you know, all that I am or can ever be is a gift. Perhaps I don't, you know, I don't believe that I can comprehend in this form that which is beyond it. I believe that Plotinus's word, ineffable, is what we're talking about. But I do know that I can look at my life and its existential facts and know that my life has revealed to me there is more than this world of shoes and ships and sealing wax.
Right.
There are things moving behind the curtain that are not available to me. And I like to think of that as spirit. If I will recognize that, I will trust in that, I will listen to it, I'm convinced that every one of us will find the way, if you will, that is why we're here. Because it's written like a blueprint, like a map inside of us.
And you wrote quickie. Extensively.
And I know we're short on time, but let me quickie here. I'm a boy, and I'm very, very religious, and this whole story is all drawn out, and what does it mean? Very, very religious. I get stuck cutting a Christmas tree. The next morning, my car drives right out of that snowstorm in exactly the same place, except there's more snow. There's no reason I should have been stuck at all in the first place.
Yeah.
I meet a man in a hotel. He attacks my faith and shreds it to pieces. I'm a 4-0 student. I'm an ordained priest.
He attacked your
and this
faith.
This man makes me feel that I'm the stupidest person on the planet. I take that information back to the seminary. I questioned my seminary teachers in classes, and they flunked me. Now, I've gotten A's on all the tests. That's just names, dates, and places. I bring them before an academic committee. They end up giving me my A as long as I never go back. So I'm a kid. I'm like 16 years old, and I've just been, what, excommunicated from my faith? Now, I don't believe in anybody. I don't believe in God. I don't believe in these authorities. They've all lied to me. This is all nonsense. I'm just going to have a good time. I get in my car. I drive to a small town in Woods Cross, Utah. I have my girlfriend with me. The car stalls on the railroad tracks. The signal arms come down. Kapowie, a train doing over 100 miles an hour with over 100 cars behind it, smacks that car. Cattle guard crushes the driver's side of the car. They have to cut Connie out of it.
Mm.
Connie is holding my knee when the car is hit by this train.
Mm.
Time, space, they pass. I'm standing in a field 100, 150 yards from everything. There's emergency vehicles everywhere.
Wow.
Goodness, where's Connie? I run down there. They stop me. Who are you? What are you doing? I was driving that car. I get into the ambulance with her. She thinks they just cut me from the car. She's surprised that I'm fine. I don't have a mark on me. We talk about this. We go to the hospital. Her family sues the railroad company. I tell this entire story in court more than once to attorneys on both sides. Nobody said anything to me about it at all.
What do you attribute that to?
Until it's all over with and my mother says to me, you know, you've changed. Are you a walk-in? I've never even heard that word. I have no clue what a walk-in is. But here's the story in that.
Hmm.
Take me out of the equation. This is a story, a pattern, and I get them all the time from people when they'll stop and look. I share a lot of them with you if we had the time.
Well, we'll have you back.
Okay. If you look at this story, here's a boy who's religious, his faith is torn, it's tattered, he turns to be atheistic, and something says, nope, that's not the right answer.
Ooh.
What does that mean?
That's for you to discover. Those are the clues that you need to start.
Book,
all of us can start.
That's
exactly.
I promise you I'll never answer
in the
it for
next,
you either.
No, I know that. And that's what we can explore in real depth the next time. I'd love to. What cues do you look for? What's the meeting? What happens when the mind and matter meet?
Eldon, it's a pleasure just to listen to your voice, Eldon.
Oh, I know, and to hear what you're sharing, and to explore that. And your book is now come. It just came out last month.
That's correct. Actually, it's in its official debut this week.
What does this is the opening week. What does that mean?
Right.
Exploring mind, meaning, and mysteries. And he just goes off from what we've been talking about. And really exploring in depth what it is to be a courageous human being. What is fear? What is purpose? And you even talk about psychic spirituality and consciousness with varying definitions. And that still small voice within. That was my favorite chapter.
Thank you, Thomas. That was a marvelous compliment. I want to get that said before I answer Cynthia here. But thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
I wanted the book to be a book cross-country line hauler could sit down and read. You know, for years I trained racehorses and hauled them around the country. And I like those cowboys and those farriers to be able to sit down in the racing stalls and read this, you know, between trips to the paddock.
And
a book that whatever lofty position an individual might be in was still worth their reading. So that's what I tried to do with What Does It Mean? It home.
And I loved what you wrote about the consciousness of animals. And that was another whole show.
Yeah, that is a show. That is a show. That brings tears to my eyes.
I know. Me too. I cried reading it. It was beautiful.
Well
thank you.
Well, I messed up, and that's why I get the tears. So I just messed
up. Oh, I know. Yeah. The death of some of your friends, animal friends. That was very touching, painful, but beautiful. The learning that you evolved from that experience.
That's why I want to share it. You know, we don't all have to do the same dumb things over and over again.
Oh, those friends. Well, thank you so much, Eldon.
My pleasure.
And your website, before we go, eldontaylor.com.
Yes, and go get your free MP3. And Cynthia and Thomas, I have loved being with you. We'll do this anytime. You're just wonderful hosts.
It's mutual.
It's like having good conversation with good friends.
And we'll go on your show.
Likewise.
Thank you so much.
Bless you. Have a good evening.
Bye-bye.
You too.
Ah, that was Dr. Eldon Taylor, and our next guest is Catherine Albrecht. We're going to be learning about spy chips and other alternative search engines that do not keep our search practices, do not keep them. Google and Microsoft and many others are, and the ways in which what we purchase is being tracked and we're being marketed. So I'm going to get a hold of Catherine, and Thomas has a song to sing for you. Do you there?
Okay.
Thank you.
You let me know when, give me some sort of heads up thing, because how about this song? Some sort of heads up when it's time to shut it down.
Thank you, Thomas. That was beautiful. Didn't hear any words. You were getting started. Well, now we have on the phone Catherine Albrecht. And let me just... Catherine, are you with us?
I sure am, Janae. Oh. It's great to be on with you.
Oh, wonderful. I'm so glad. We only have half an hour. And I just want our listeners to know a little bit about you. Catherine Albrecht, she's one of our foremost authority on issues of privacy right now and government surveillance and... She also is the director of Caspian. It's Consumers Against Supermarket Privacy Invasion and Numbering. And you founded that in 1999 to advocate free market, consumer-based solutions to the problem of retail privacy invasion. And you regularly speak on consumer privacy and civil liberties and how they impact new technologies, particularly the RFID and retail sales. And most recently, you've been working with is an Ixquick and Startpage. That is an alternative search engine. And that's real timely now. You wrote a letter talking about the discussions concerning Microsoft in Google and how they have been copying a lot of our search practices.
Yeah, you know, people don't realize that probably the biggest database ever in all of human history collected on individual citizens across the globe is being quietly amassed by, of all organizations, Google. Google makes a record of every single thing that you search for on the Internet. And people might kind of say, well, yeah, I kind of knew that. But if you think about the implications of that, they've really amassed a dossier of information on American citizens that would have been the envy of the KGB. Never in the history of humanity have we been able to amass so much information about the contents of people's minds, their political views, their health, their relationship concerns, their job concerns, all of the things that we worry about, think about, and that construct the daily contents of our lives, we are typing unthinkingly into the Google search engine. And they are watching us back. We tend to think of a search engine as kind of a servant, and we use them with privacy. We're in a room, we've got the door shut, nobody's looking over our shoulder, and we call up this little servant, sort of like in the old days opening an encyclopedia or going to the library, and we ask questions and we get answers, and we think that it's just a one-way street, just like I said, opening a book mm-hmm. and getting an answer. But what you don't realize is that every search that you make, and I don't want to single out Google, I could point to Yahoo and Bing as well, every search that you make on these search engines is recorded. It is subjected to very powerful data mining software that uses those searches to determine things about you. And as a result, these companies have incredibly detailed dossiers about you. And let me give you just a sense, Janae, of what I'm talking about, just so people can kind of personalize this a little bit. Let's say a woman has a miscarriage, a tragic event, a very personal event, something she wouldn't share potentially with her coworkers, may not even share with her sister or her own mother. Very personal event, but yet she would log on to a search engine and look it up in order to get information or perhaps find some online support. Well, Google would make a record of that. Mm. Let's say that you're concerned about losing your job. You might log on and look up unemployment benefits, even though you may not tell other people you're worried. You might not even tell your husband you think you mm-hmm. might lose your job, but you might log on to Google. Now Google has a record of that as well. Mm-hmm. You go to the doctor, you get a diagnosis and a prescription. You look up the illness on Google. You look up the side effects of the medication. Now they know about your health and what you're taking. You're fighting with your spouse. You're concerned about your marriage. Your teenage son needs drug rehab. Whatever it might be, you look up counseling on Google. Now they know that about you. It's extraordinary, the fact that they are keeping all of this information, and they are slicing it and dicing it. They're making it available to advertisers, and they're using it in unprecedented ways. And not only that, but people should also realize, if you have a Gmail account, and if you are, or if you're writing to someone with a Gmail account, that Google is also reading all of your email. And if you write in your email about drug counseling, or if you write in your email about a vacation to Miami, they make a record of that. They add those keywords into your personal profile that they keep on you. And they use that information to serve you personalized ads as you surf the Internet. Not only do they do that, but they make a record of all of the websites that you visit on the Internet that run Google ads. And that goes into your dossier, into your profile. So it's really, when you sit back and you look at the size and the enormity of how much information one single company now, a multi-billion dollar company, one of the wealthiest companies on the globe, how much information they've amassed about us as individuals, then it makes perfect sense why the government, the communist regime in China, has hacked into Google's database to try to get access to the honeypot of information that Google has. Mm-hmm. So it's really shocking to actually sit back and say, wait a minute, I thought I was just using a search engine, when you realize that you've been unthinkingly contributing massive amounts of information to probably the most powerful database of information on Earth about you.
And I would assume that there's no regulation of that database, because it's a private company and they can do whatever they want with it. And in other words, you already said that they sell it to advertisers.
Well, what they do, let me tell you how it works. Mm-hmm. Somebody told me they had this disturbing experience, and I'll explain how they had this experience. They were writing to a friend. They had a Gmail account. They wrote to a friend something about remembering and laughing over a 1970s episode of Scooby-Doo that they both watched.
Mm-hmm.
And the following day, she's on some totally unrelated website, some jewelry website. And on that website, all of a sudden, there's an ad for Scooby-Doo. And she thought, oh, isn't that a funny coincidence? I was just thinking about Scooby-Doo. Then the following day, she's on another website, totally unrelated, having something to do with, I don't know, cars, and there's another ad for Scooby-Doo. And every place she goes now, she's starting to see these Scooby-Doo ads, and she says, now that's just weird. So she contacted me and said, what's going on? Who knows? How do they know? And I said, well, next time you see one of those ads, take a look, and right underneath it, it'll say ads by Google. And she says, well, yeah, but I wasn't on Google. I didn't type a Scooby-Doo search into Google, and I wasn't on Google's website. I said, it doesn't matter. Right now, huge swaths of the Internet are paid for and funded by Google Ads. And the way they work is, this is why the dossier is so detailed on you. Because let's say you land on the car part website or some other informational website or some news website, and they're running an ad. Rather than run an ad for car parts, which might make the most logical sense from our perspective, they say, well, wait a minute, you may not really be a person who's into car parts. You're more into Scooby-Doo. So what they do is when you land on the website, the car part website interacts instantly with Google's database. It looks at your cookies and identifies who you are based on your cookies from your previous Google visits, which are sitting right there on your browser for anybody to see except you. It quickly asks Google and says, hey, we got one of your people on our website, which is like 95% of us anyway. One of your people's on our website. Tell us about that person and give us an ad that pertains to them. And so Google now knows, first of all, that you were on the car part website because they share that information back to Google so that they can get the ad. They know which pages you clicked and which links you clicked on the car parts website, what time you got there, how long you spent there. And on top of that, they accessed your cookies to figure out in your profile what you're interested in so they could put the right ad on the car part website. So let's say you write to somebody and you say, hey, I'm looking forward to playing tennis this weekend. All of a sudden, tennis ads start appearing. Or I'm looking forward to my Miami vacation next month. All of a sudden, you start getting ads for vacation properties in Miami. And this is how the whole system works. Now, some people may say, big deal. I don't care if marketers know about me. They're just marketers, after all. Who cares? Here's where this gets really disturbing. Yeah. The government. The government knows right now that Google has a more powerful database than they do. Google's database knows more about you than the FBI, the IRS, the NSA, any other database out there. Google's got the goods on everybody.
Mm.
And so when it's time for a subpoena or a warrant or just a phishing expedition, Google is where they're going to automatically go. It's why the Chinese government hacked them. Now, Google has already shown that it doesn't have a problem with this. There was an interview with Eric Schmidt, Google's CEO, a couple months ago with Maria Bartiromo on television. And in this interview, Eric Schmidt said, yeah, we watch everything you do. We make a record of everything you do. If you don't want us to know about it, you shouldn't be searching for it.
There you go.
And we will turn it over to the government in response to a Patriot Act request. Now, I want you to think for just a minute. By the way, the Patriot Act is due to sunset on Sunday, and it's being voted on by Congress right now to extend its provisions.
I thought it was extended.
Clause 215 in the Patriot Act allows them to, with a simple request, obtain any business record from any business in the U.S. on request. And they have to, because of the Patriot Act, turn over your data to them. So this is exactly what could happen with the Patriot Act. Google's already acknowledged that they don't have a problem turning it over. So now let's say, instead of looking for terrorists, that instead what Google decides, or what the Patriot Act, federal officials say, tell us everybody in the country who has a gun. Or tell us everybody in the country who's taken a position pro and con on the issue of abortion. Mm-hmm. Or disturbingly, the MIAC report, the Missouri Information Awareness Report that came out last year, identified as potential domestic terrorists anyone who had an interest in third-party candidates, like Constitution Party candidate Chuck Baldwin, anybody who had an interest in Ron Paul, who was a Republican candidate, those people were identified as potential domestic terrorists. They said anyone who has taken a position pro or con on the issue of abortion and publicly taken a stand on that is a potential domestic terrorist. They said anyone with an interest in the Constitution, for heaven's sakes, was a potential domestic terrorist. That would mean every judge sitting on every bench in every courthouse in America if they're doing their job.
So, Catherine, if you're identified as such, who's doing that identification?
Well, that's the concern.
And what are the consequences of that? What does
that
mean?
Let's say I wanted to know all the Ron Paul supporters.
Are you on a no-fly list or something?
Well, the consequences, I think, down the road are where this becomes really chilling.
Scary.
Because you can look at historical precedent, and you can say, well, what did the Germans do? What did the East Germans in you know, with the KGB under
gas
Stalin.
Chambers.
What did these people do? Well, they identified people who opposed their rule. They rounded them up and they shot them.
They did.
You know, in China, they identified these
dissidents
and they put them in labor camps. Right now, if you're in China and you oppose the government and speak out publicly, you wind up in a labor camp or worse.
Yeah, I know.
So that's the potential that this has, and
yeah.
I think it's chilling.
It
that's
is.
The reason why I've devoted the last year of my life to promoting alternative search engines and trying to get people out of Google. And again, it's not just Google. It's Yahoo. It's Bing. It's all the big guys.
What about Mozilla?
Well, Mozilla is actually, that's your Firefox browser.
Mm-hmm.
That's your browser, which is not involved in the specific capturing of what goes through it, because it's software on your computer,
Okay. Fortunately.
So it's more these companies that we're giving the information to voluntarily, or so they argue, that we're giving them this information, therefore they have a right to store it, keep it, and use it however they see fit.
And
so the alternative, if I could suggest
I'm just going to ask you. Yeah, it's quick.
There is a company out there. When I first found this out last year, I went nuts. I've been using Google, even though I'm a privacy advocate, for 10 years. And when
I've been following you. You're great. It's wonderful to have you on here.
Thank
Catherine,
you.
Thank you.
When I actually understood the enormity of what was being created and how unaware Americans were and people around the globe, I said, that's it. I'm not going to go back. I'm not going to use Google again. And if that means I can't search the net, then so be it. And fortunately, I found a search engine alternative called StartPage, which is StartPage, like Start Protecting Your Privacy, or the Start Page where you can start your searches on the
internet. I thought it was IxQuick.
Well, IxQuick is the European name. And IxQuick.com. So they have two names. They're IxQuick in Europe, and their U.S. servers are under StartPage.com.
And they do not record your address.
They don't. And they've actually been third-party
no
certified. They don't record your IP address. They don't put cookies on your browser, and they don't store a record of your searches.
Wonderful.
So even if they got subpoenaed or if the Patriot Act request came to them, they would have nothing to turn over. They would literally have no data to hand.
So they have nothing personal on you?
Nothing at all. In fact, they can't even state whether or not you've been on their website, because they don't have any records of who's been on their website. They know nothing about their users.
Okay, so I'll go home and change over.
StartPage, yeah, and when you go to the homepage, if you go to StartPage.com, it's just a very simple search engine. You type in your search. Three things I want to bring to people's attention. One of them is that they have a brand new proxy service, which means that the websites that you find that you want to connect to, you can connect to through StartPage using the proxy. Underneath every result, it'll say the word proxy. And what that means is, instead of you linking directly to the website where they can see you, put cookies on your browser, and track what you do on the site, you can go there indirectly through StartPage. StartPage will get the page for you, put it through their servers, and serve it to you privately.
So you click on proxy, and then the site cannot put any cookies on you.
Precisely, and that way nobody knows where you are on the net. You're totally private. To learn about that, there's a video right on the homepage on the right-hand side at startpage.com. It says our new proxy. Click here to watch the video. And if people want to know what I look like, I'm the spokesperson in the video explaining how it works.
Uh-huh.
So there's a two-minute video that shows you how to use
it,
what
it
does. Yeah, you can see me right there. And then the other thing, right underneath the search bar, there's a little link that says Add StartPage to Your Browser. And if you click that, it'll, up in the upper right-hand corner of your browser, you know how there's a little window? Typically, people use it for Google searches. You can just punch in your search and hit go or whatever, and it gives you a page of Google search results.
Mm-hmm.
You can click that Add Start Page to Your Browser, and Start Page will be one of the options in the pull-down menu. So if you want to look up Scooby-Doo, you can type Scooby-Doo in there. click on Start Page, and it will give you the page of Scooby-Doo results that nobody knows you looked for.
Oh, what fun. Oh,
it's
that
cool
feels,
stuff. And
yeah.
The way it works, the way the search engine works, it's not, how would I explain this? It's not creating the search results on its own. It's actually going out to the top search engines for you. So it goes to Yahoo, it goes to Bing, it goes to Ask.com, it goes to all of these other search engines for you as a proxy. So it submits your request on your behalf to all of the search engines, 11 of them, gets the top results and then serves them back to you, but those search engines never know you were there and never know that you searched them, because they only see that StartPage is there.
You know, I have a question. I did use, I've called it IxQuick for a while, and I'm going to go back to using it. I found that initially it wasn't as extensive as Google.
Yeah, and I'll tell you why. Because Google is a multi-billion dollar corporation. Mm-hmm. They have a team of some of the top software engineers on the globe working around the clock to give you the best search results. They also give you all kinds of free services, Gmail. They give you Google Maps, Google
True.
Street View, Google Satellite yeah. Images, Google Books. They're soon going to be delivering the electricity into your home and monitoring your use of your appliances.
Really? Are you
Google
serious?
Google Electricity, yep, as part of the smart grid. They're going to be managing our electronic medical records. One of the Google founders just married a woman who runs a company called 23andMe, where they want to map all of our chromosomes and put those up on Google. I'm not making this up.
I know you wouldn't.
So what you need to understand is that there is something that
alarming.
I call the privacy tax. And I pay it all the time, or you could call it the liberty tax.
Uh-huh.
If my search results are only 95% as good when I use StartPage than if I use Google,
mm-hmm.
and I sacrifice a small bit of efficiency, and by the way, it's very small. I've used nothing but StartPage for the last year.
Mm-hmm.
And at first I said, gee, these aren't quite as good of results, and I will acknowledge that, but they're 95% as good.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I view that is unless we start exercising our liberty muscle now, when it's easy to mm-hmm. simply pay a price in terms of a slightly reduced efficiency, or if it's paying cash instead of using a credit card, then how are we going to be able to respond when the going really gets rough?
Yeah.
So I view it, my husband and I talk about this all the time, we pay the privacy tax a thousand and different ways. We have toll booths here in New Hampshire in the Live Free or Die state, and we pay cash at the toll booth. We refuse to put one of those tracking devices on our card as if it's a toll booth.
I wouldn't
do that. We pay twice as much to get through the toll booth. It takes us twice as long, and we do it with a smile on our face and a sense of virtue in our hearts
mm-hmm.
because I'm paying a privacy tax. I'm undergoing a little bit of inconvenience for the future generations. Mm-hmm. I'm undergoing that convenience to keep services like that alive.
Yeah.
I'm undergoing that inconvenience because that's how I vote, not just with my dollars and with my time, but I vote with my
use of a search engine.
With my use of these things.
Yeah.
So
Good point.
Am very conscious of how my actions, you know, what is the saying? Act as though, be the change you want to see.
Yeah, Gandhi.
Act as though what you were doing were to become a universal rule. Well, yeah. I'd love universally for everybody to stop using Google, Yahoo, and Bing, so I don't use them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love for everybody to stop putting toll transponders in their car and using tracking devices and credit cards, so I don't use them. And hopefully
using
that carves
cash.
Out a little bit of space for other people to make those good choices, too.
Yeah. Given all the fact that we're tracked so closely now and monitored and the dangers involved in that, I know you have to go at 3:30, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about the RFID chips and... Can you say a little bit about that for our listeners?
Absolutely.
Retail
what I'd like
privacy
to
invasion.
There's two things that, and I know we've only got about 5 minutes left, so let me give people two resources, or actually a couple of resources that they can go to learn more. RFID is radio frequency identification tags. We call them spy chips. They're miniature antennas hooked up to, microchips hooked up to antennas that transmit information at a distance. They can be placed into belongings. They can be put into credit cards, passports, ID cards. They can be woven into the seams of your clothing or pressed between your shoes. They can even be injected into human flesh. That's what they're putting into dogs. The VeriChip implant is the human version of that. And you can learn all about our research on implantable microchips if you go to antichips.com. We've got legislation up there. We've got the cancer study. I actually work closely with the Associated Press to break the story that those microchips cause cancer in laboratory animals. Between 1 and 10% of them injected with an RFID microchip develops a tumor around it, fast-growing malignant cancerous tumor. So you don't want to put that in your dog. You don't want to put it in grandma. You certainly don't want to put it in your kids. And you can learn all about that and see the evidence, the original research, and all of the academic research on that by going to antichips.com. I have a brand new, groundbreaking documentary film out called Shadow Government. Michael Shaw, who's an activist right there in Santa Cruz, is one of the stars of the film.
Who's that, Michael Shaw?
I love Michael Shy. He's fabulous. He works on Agenda 21 issues, and he owns some beautiful property there in Santa Cruz. And he's been prevented from developing under all of the rules there in Santa Cruz. So he's become quite a property rights activist, and he's a brilliant, brilliant man, talking about how the UN is very much involved in cracking down on people's property rights. And he is in the film. So I actually flew out and spent some time in Santa Cruz on a beautiful mountainside overlooking the Pacific Ocean and filmed him for that movie.
Oh.
So you can find that, Shadow Government. If you go to my website, I do a daily radio show. My website is KatherineAlbrecht.com. And if you forget, you can just look up RFID. My name's all over there. But it's Katherine with a K, Albrecht, ALBRECHT.com. Mm-hmm. And if you click on products on the right-hand side, that is where you can find a trailer for the movie. You can find excerpts from the film. I believe Michael's in one of those. And you can also find an order form where you can order a copy of Shadow Government. People are doing showings of this all over the country. It is the state of the moment 2010 update on what's going on with all of these Big Brother tracking technologies. And it ties it in with sort of the big picture. Why is this happening? Who's on board? Who's involved? And I should give you a heads up. The last 5 minutes of the film are Christian, but it's a 90-minute movie, and if that's not your cup of tea, if you just skip the last 5 minutes, there's mm-hmm. not a heavy-handed Christian message elsewhere in the movie. But I am a Christian, and I do believe that this has some spiritual implications as well, the sort of enslavement of humanity.
Well, I always look for the similarities in spiritual practices myself.
It's heavy stuff, and in fact, I even found that in Islam, somebody just sent me this link that one of the prophets of Islam actually said that the world will end when a man can leave his home and use his staff or his shoe to check in on his family.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, that sounds like a cell phone or a BlackBerry or some other thing that they're working on today. So who knows where we're going, but I think we all agree that there's a lot of spiritual things going on right now.
There are to counter a lot of this madness.
Absolutely. So my websites are antichips.com, KatherineAlbrecht.com, where I have archives of my radio show, and you can listen live to the show from 1 to 3 p.m. your time.
Okay.
At that website, if you just click on Radio Show, there's a Listen Live button.
All right.
And also an archive so people can hear previous shows. And the order form is there if you want to get a copy of Shadow Government. And if you want to understand where all this surveillance really, what it's all about, and you're a reader, then our best-selling book, Spy Chips, is also available through that order form, and I'll be glad to send people.
Thomas has a copy right here, How Major Corporations and Government Plan to Track Your Every Purchase and Watch Your Every Move.
That's the one, Spy Chips.
He's got it.
And I can get signed copies of both of those out into people's hands, and I'd love to have the help of the people of Santa Cruz to spread the word.
Thank you. And if there are any updates or something else you want to relay, just give us a call, and we'll put you on again.
Well, bless you so much, Janae. It's been a pleasure being on your show.
Thank
you,
Catherine.
And blessings to all your listeners as well.
And thanks for the heads up on the startpage.com.
Yeah. Awesome. I hope you use it. And drop me a line. Let me know what you think after you try it.
There's a wealth of information here.
Okay. God bless you both.
Thank you. Bye-bye. I got the line down before we get a dial tone. I'm getting better at this. Now, Thomas, hopefully you'll have some time to sing. Our next guest is Rafael Moria, and he's in Brasilia, Brazil, and he's going to be talking to us about the corruption of the government in Brasilia. Apparently they are experiencing their version of Watergate now. Their governor is in prison. I don't know if he was released or not. He may be forced to resign, or they may be impeaching him as well as the vice governor. And they're closely allied with a lot of construction firms that are now developing indigenous land that is very close to Brasilia. And that's what we're going to be talking about next. And that should be about 4:15. So Thomas is going to play some beautiful music for you before that, and you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM online. That's www.freakradio.org, and we're always looking for donations, and you can mail those to FRSC PO Box 7811 95061. Where else can you get the diversity of programming that you have here?
Nowhere else. Nowhere.
All right.
This is it.
There you go.
So this is a song about, well, it's pretty self-explanatory, and it's about where all the stuff comes from, all the stuff. Mm-hmm.
coffee haste, strive to open your eyes. Walk out the doorway, dawning is lightning. Take time to realize there's magic out here, power that flows on all sides. Yes, something more real than the job gets you your wage. For what would you buy without the gifts of the land, sea, and sky? So as you go through your day, any way that you may, in one of the myriad forms, remember, give thanks to the power that made you, the same that sustained you today. Yes, for we humans were clever, and we rearrange much that we see into patterns that shape our versions of reality. Yes, and it's easily lost at such a cost that we are children of our Mother Earth. Children, we all are as children, we are as children, we are the children, we are children, we all are as children, we are as children. Children, we are children, we are children, we all are as children, we are the children, children, we are children, by mother children, by mother children, by mother, mother.
Well, there you have it. Janae is doing her best to line up.
You know, I love that song. And we are the caretakers of the land. The next person we're going to be interviewing is talking about that. And all over the planet, she's in jeopardy. And he's from Brazil and doing some real good work with fighting corruption, really articulating the needs of the people, the sacred land that's going to be about to be developed. And then as you listen to what he has to say, he's going to need our help. It's an international cry. You know, it's happening everywhere, but today we're going to be centering on what's happening in Brazil. And as you sang that song, you know, we're children of this land. I've always seen her as a mother. She nurtures us and needs our care. And if we despoil her, we all cease to exist, literally.
And it's just not nice to be mean to your mother.
No.
And truly, the whole idea of where does all the stuff all the stuff that we buy, barter, beg, or
beg,
steal.
Borrow, and steal.
It all comes from Mother
we
Earth.
We just steal it. Yep.
It's all created for free, and it's simply our distribution systems that have got us in this have-not situation. And all we need to do is just straighten that out. We could have heaven on earth. Sounds pretty simple, doesn't it?
I think we have a way of making it a lot more complex.
But that's the reality. That's the reality. That all the stuff.
The stuff. Too much stuff.
For us.
Was what?
Was all made for us. It's all gifts.
Yeah.
It's all a gift.
And if you know of anyone who is working with indigenous groups or working to somehow alleviate the pain that we're all suffering amidst the cultural mores, let me know who they are, and you can email me, and I'll interview them, Janaea, J-A-N-E-A, 95076, @yahoo.com. And I'll be real grateful to have some well-spoken, articulate individuals speak in her defense.
Mm-hmm.
And in defense of our rights, spiritual practices. You know, let me know who you have in mind.
Sounds good. And are they going to be reading those emails?
Yeah, they might be after what Catherine said, you know. We'll use IXQuick or Start Page here. IXQuick is in England. Yeah, that was pretty alarming. I knew we were being tracked, but I didn't know to the extent to which the information was being used. And I don't want to be on the no-fly list because I'm planning on flying quite a bit this summer, and I want to cross borders with grace and ease.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Do you use the computer that much?
I don't use the computer that much, but I also have this idea that everything that we say or do is being observed by somebody. If it's not by somebody human,
it feels like that, doesn't it?
It's by some greater power. So
yes.
Just do your best, you know, and
But best is relative. I don't want to do my best.
Best is relative. The fact of having some entity, human entity, gathering information to utilize is
it's very invasive. And of what right? We deserve our privacy, and I've always been an ardent privacy advocate, and that's why I asked Catherine on, and I think she's the number one expert in the world when it comes to our privacy rights.
Mm-hmm.
She's
mm-hmm.
tracked literally everything, and she walks her talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very important, and certainly if there's an alternative to utilizing stuff like Google and Gmail for greater privacy, it's incumbent upon those of us that want to have
to utilize
that
it.
To do it. Yeah, utilize it.
What do you see as some of the dangers?
Well, in and of itself, it's the gathering of information is just it's just hoarding of information. It's just privacy violations, but every once in a while, there's some perturbation of human behavior that
yes.
surfaces that could take information that is available and utilize it to push whatever agenda that perturbation may be pushing. Maybe that, we don't like people of a certain type, and we're not going to tolerate them anymore. And with that information available, and so extensively available, it puts it probably in greater risk that some political stance in some mm-hmm. future time would utilize that information for, dare I say, nefarious ends.
And it's bizarre. This isn't a real danger, but it's how closely tracked we are. I'm not a home buyer. I'm not in the market to buy a home, but my roommate is. And lately I've been getting a deluge of ads pertaining to home buying and mortgage rates. And mm-hmm. couldn't figure out why. So I went down and I asked him what was going on, if he was looking online. And he said he was. And we don't share the same computer, but somehow the wires must have been crossed. Then I was talking to someone else who is selling Avon. and she was using my computer, went on to look at Avon, see how her sales were doing, I guess. And suddenly I'm receiving a lot of ads from Avon, wrinkle creams. I mean, some of it I could use, but, you know, it was just, it's amazing how well-tracked we are.
Mm-hmm.
They don't leave any stones unturned.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to sing another song? I'm going to get in touch with our next guest, Raphael. He's going to be coming on about 4:15. So let's see if I can get him on now. Stay tuned. It's great.
Stay tuned. I have to. Speaking of tune, I'm gonna do a little bit of tuning here. And at the tuning, as I'm doing that, making sure it's all tuned up, I'll just give you the background. I love metaphors. A friend of mine told me recently that metaphors are God's way of speaking to us. God, higher power, spirit, whatever you prefer. God's way of speaking to us. So the metaphor for this song that I was thinking of is, what if life is like a kitchen? Not fully developed. I mean, I could go a lot longer with it, but this is the bit that's developed so far.
Thank you, Thomas. That was beautiful. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for listening.
Oh, yeah. You bet. Well, we have Rafael Moriara now, and he's in Brasilia, Brazil, and he's going to be talking about the massive corruption in Brasilia and the development of what is indigenous sacred land. And apparently they are experiencing, as I mentioned earlier, a Watergate of sorts, and we're going to be learning about the governor and the vice governor. Brasilia's governor of the Federal District of Brasilia, José Roberto Arruda, apparently was imprisoned and for corruption. And the vice governor, Paulo Octavio, also is implicated in this Pandora's box. So welcome. Rafael, are you with us? Rafael, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yes,
I'm
there you are. Welcome. You're on the air now. It's Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Rafael,
yes. And I'm sorry, how do you pronounce your last name? Was it Moriara?
How I pronounce it, Rafael?
Rafael, all right. And you're part of, what is the name of the organization, Go Out Arruda? Fora Arruda.
I'm part of the movement called Go Out Arruda and Mafia.
Ah, which is,
Arruda to the mafia.
And Arruda, he was the governor of the Federal District of Brasilia.
That, yes, his name is called Arruda.
Arruda.
Arruda. It's written A-R-R-U-D-A.
A-R-R-U-D-A. José Roberto.
Yes.
And what happened? He was caught off trying to bribe someone. He was caught. Can you give us a brief history as to why he is in jail and then the development of the land, the indigenous land that's very sacred?
Then for those who don't know, I'm going to locate Brasilia. I'm going to situate where I'm living. Brasilia is the youngest capital of Latin America. It was like built in the 60s. After like Brazil, capitals was like Rio and Salvador, they were located on the coast. In Brazil, it was built in the 60s, it was done like in 5 years.
Yes.
Since then, a lot of employees came from different parts of Brazil to Brasilia in order to get a job, in order, you know.
Yes.
And then a lot of people came here, and these people, one of these groups was some Indian group. For the northeast of Brazil, they came to Brazilia to work. They were pioneers. They worked in the construction sector, building houses, building schools, building, you know, buildings. And they started to make a community somehow, located in the Amazonas, in the left, on the north wing of Brasilia.
Yes.
And this community is now with, I think, almost 40 years or more than 40 years. And they are now in danger because where they live, they're going to have like a huge huge neighborhood plan to be constructed where they are living. And this area is the last green area of the urban plan of Brasilia. Then it's like, it's amazing now because they were never mentioned in the history of Brazil, not even of Brasilia. It's like somehow they are appearing now on the news, but they are being, the construction system with the advertising of this neighborhood was trapped, a house of an Indian was burned, and then that's what's happening now. Like the governor of Brasilia, he's the one, like, he's the main person. He's the main guy who wants to build this neighborhood because it's going to be like the most expensive neighborhood of Brazil. And he's advertising it like an ecological neighborhood. They are devastating a green area and calling it an ecological neighborhood. Like,
so
the most ecological neighborhood of Brazil.
Hey, Rafael. So basically, through the years, a lot of the indigenous have been coming into Brasilia, and then they were given some land that is very sacred to them.
Yay.
And now this governor, who's now behind bars, from what I understand, has been, he's involved with contractors to develop the land. Does he have his own business? So the people are going to be moved off of the land, and it's going there. Did you say they're advertising it as an ecological village?
Yeah, amazing. I'm not kidding. The main track here is controlled by the governor and his vice governor, which is a businessman. They control the main press, the radio programs, TV programs, and it's really advertising. Right now, they have destroyed some, like a huge area. This area, which we call the nature with the devastation, is called Cerrado. The Cerrado is like a tiny vegetation, like a savanna. It's really a rich savanna. Like,
I'm having a hard time hearing you. Is there a way you could speak maybe a little bit more closely into the phone or something? I'm just not sure. All right.
Yeah.
Let me see if that's a little different. Is this a cell phone?
It is a cell phone, yeah. If you want, you can call me at home.
Oh, would you rather I call you
better.
Okay.
I think it may be better.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think so, because I'm straining my ears, and I want to make sure our listeners hear that.
What's the number, Barfail?
My number is 333, like you have to call first, 61, which is the code for Brasilia.
Yes.
Then you call 33-47.
57?
33-47.
47.
47. 47. Then it's 47, 34.
6133-4734. I'll call you right back. All right.
Nice.
Bye-bye.
And then I'm waiting. 3357. Nice. I'm waiting.
I'll call you right back. Great.
Yeah. Go ahead and make that phone call. So it sounds like the same situation that's happened many times in these two continents of Turtle Island, i.e. North America and South America, where the idea of the land being a living entity is one side of the equation, or the one side of the cultural divide. The other side of the cultural divide is that the land is something that is a commodity and can be divided and then bought and sold. So we'll see how it's playing out in Brasilia. One of the things about Brazil is there is still quite a bit of land and quite a bit of indigenous tribes that still have their original connection to their earth-based cultures. And for the amount of earth-based cultures that we have left intact, we certainly would be well served to protect and preserve them, because they are the keepers of one of the keys for leading us back to our connection to Mother Earth, those of us that have lost it. Part of what we were speaking about with Eldon at the beginning is the many people in our country culture have minds that are essentially fed enough mainstream information that we're not capable of thinking critically, and we are quite divorced from actually hands-on experience with our life, even getting food, even spending time in nature. There's actually even a term for nature deprivation. There's a psychiatric malady that's been labeled in our culture for those of us who do not spend enough time in nature. So it's very important that not only that we respect and protect the cultures that still have this direct connect to Mother Earth, it's also important for all of us to realize that we all have that direct connect to Mother Earth. And who doesn't stand upon the earth? That's where it's our home. It's our home. To to think of Mother Earth as simply being a ball of material that's hurtling through space as pretty limited to the Gaia hypothesis that Mother Earth actually does have consciousness, and that consciousness is there for all of us to tap into. It's certainly more interesting. I mean, what would you rather be on, a super ball hurtling through space that's just there, or would you rather be hurtling through space with an interactive ball of intelligence that also produces all your food, water, shelter, and oxygen? Read recently some writing by Luther Standing Bear, a Lakota man who was at the middle part of the 1800s, fairly early on in the 20th century. But he wrote about the old ones and the Lakota idea of when laying on the earth, actually holding in their minds, the old people would hold in their minds the idea of being nestled in their mother's lap. And I will take that as a practice of my own to feel that I'm being held by my mother when I lay upon the earth, and take time to connect back in with mom once in a while. I mean, I live thousands away, miles away from my birth mother, and I'm a little big for sitting in her lap anymore anyhow, but I'll never be too big to sit on the lap of mother, Madre Tierra. It was very interesting reading this, Luther Standing Bear's rendition of this mindset, that instead of the globe that we live on just being something to be utilized for whatever, boys with bulldozers, that is actually sitting in your mother's arms, on your mother's lap. So at the least, it's certainly where we all germinated. All life germinated there. So there's no need to make it any more or less than that. That without the platform, there's no performance. There's no human performance without the platform of Mother Earth upon which it starts, and upon which we from which we sprang. So I get to fill your ears, and I'm very actually feel honored to have the opportunity to do so. I'll tell you about something else I've been getting information-wise lately, a book by Farley Mowat called Sea of Slaughter. A rather gruesome title. But what Mr. Mowat, he's a Canadian author, I hope he's still in the body, and a naturalist of his own right. He writes about, in this volume, all the life forms that were so abundant on Turtle Island when the Europeans started interfacing with this continent. And I'm so glad that I'm reading at this time of my life, because I have so much compassion for how out of balance our forefathers were. Forefathers, and by extension, foremothers. But I'll tell you, it was largely, here we were, it was largely the guys, being sent out in boats, sent out in armies, sent out on hunting expeditions. But they're in an unbalanced way. One of the reasons we were so unbalanced is we didn't have our women with us a lot of the times. Over in Europe, we just got through going through the Inquisition, during which pretty much anybody who demonstrated any psychic ability, who had knowledge of herbs, who spoke with any spirits, who had visions, who was clairvoyant, telepathic,
Hi, Raphael.
Were destroyed.
Yes, much better. Well,
and then we came over here. And interesting read Farley Mowat about all the millions and millions of animals that populated this continent.
Okay.
some of which are completely gone, much like the millions and millions of human beings. More later.
Back to the real now time in Brazil.
Yes, we have Rafael back on a landline, so hopefully we'll be able to hear him a lot better. Rafael, hi.
Well, now I think the connection is better.
It's much better. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, better. Substantial. Now, if you wouldn't mind just giving our listeners a little history again, we can make it brief about the corruption and how it's affecting.
I'm very glad to be with you, all the listeners. Then I'm going
Thank
to
you.
Make a little portrait of the history somehow of Brazil, of course. Then I'm going to focus it like in the history of Brasilia. Then what I'm going to say that before Brasilia, the capitals of Brazil were Salvador and Rio. They were on the coast, and it was located in the center of Brazil. It was constructed in the 60s. In 1961, Brasilia was built in 5 years, and then a lot of people came to Brasilia to construct it. A lot of workers, people, mainly poor people from the northeast of Brazil, they came to Brasilia because Brasilia was advertised as the land of hope, as the land that something could be better for the future, that could they could, when they get here, they could get job, they would have like a quality of life somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And then during this day, different groups of people came to Brasilia. One specific group came here. They were from Indians from the northeast of Brasilia,
yes.
From an ethnic which we call Funio.
Uh-huh.
They came here in 1957 to construct Brasilia. And since then, they have started a community here. And I think like we are going to complete on the 21 of April, 50 years. Since then, they are living here. They are participating of the society somehow. And then they have this community. But till today, this community is not recognized. It's not recognized. It's under threat of being destroyed.
Yes.
Yeah, because it's like there is a huge neighborhood being planned to be constructed over their land, over where they are living. And somehow they are near the urban center of Brasilia. They are in the last green area of Brasilia. They are living near the National Park of Brasilia.
It's the last green area.
The last green
area.
It's
a national park that they're actually living in. Well, it was like their land originally.
Originally. They are from the northeast of Brasilia, but before the construction of Brasilia, this area, it was like all, there was a route of Indians, because the Indians were escaping from slavery,
yes.
And they used this land to, you know, there were some communities here before them, in fact, but they were killed, they were enslaved, and they were like kidnapped to other areas. And like we have in Brasilia archaeological sites, but all these archaeological sites are being destroyed also by the construction sector,
mm-hmm.
which is like we have an amazing, we have like archaeological sites of many, many, many years which are not being preserved. Then for most people here in Brazil, it's an amazing thing that Indians comes out like somehow. Because we have never had like a discussion about the Indian situations in Brasilia.
Really?
For instance, in 1999, an Indian of the ethnic of Pataxó, which is an ethnic from the northeast of Brazil, he was killed here while he was sleeping on the bus station.
Oh.
His body was burned, like he had 90% of his body burned, but a group of youngsters here of Brasilia. And nothing happened with these kids. Like they are free. They went to school. They studied. They went in the universities. And he became a symbol of what's happening now with this community. Like he was the first case, not the first case, but we had other cases. Last year, one Indian, he was killed. Also here in Brasilia, he was like. There was a quarrel in a bar, then after this quarrel, someone caught a knife and stabbed him like he was killed. And there are some lot of Indians living in Brazil, because Brazil is the capital. Then the Indians come from all over the country in order to be recognized, in order to go to the Congress, in order to look for their rights. And then they come here, they don't have space to live in. Like, they don't have, like, they, when they get here, they are like beggars. They have to live in the streets. There's no, like, what's happening in the Baranau community is like an example of the lack of democracy that they are living here, like, since this 500 years of Brazil.
So the Baranau community is the one that's endangered right now.
Yes, they're in danger. Like, a house of an Indian was burned some years ago and nothing was done. It's not being investigated. And
did you say a house was burned?
Was burned. While there was a house of... the owner of this house, an Indian, he was traveling because he does, like... He travels to... Because he has a group of dance and music, and then he goes to different congress in Brazil to spread his culture. Then he was traveling at once, and then when he came back, his house was burned with all his clothes, with all his documents, all his photos. It's like what we are seeing now is like Brazil is disrespecting the international laws and the, like in our constitutional law, they are disrespecting aspects of honor laws. They are disrespecting all the laws that came mentioned about human rights, about the Indian rights, and then it's like, it's amazing. We are in the capital, but it seems like nothing is happening, nothing's being advertised, and it's quite amazing what's happening here. It's terrifying for people. It makes you feel really astonished. We're feeling an atmosphere of dictatorship somehow.
A dictatorship?
The governor of Arruda, Arruda and Paulo Otávio here. I don't know. It's really strange, like, what we are living now here in Brazil. Because now Arruda is in jail. It's the first time one governor is arrested.
And that's Arruda. He was arrested, and that was for corruption?
For corruption. It's the first case of a governor here in Brazil that is arrested while he's still in power. And not only him, but there are 10 deputies being investigated. There is there is a structural scheme that was built by him to control the city, not only the deputies, but the press, but all the powers, the institutional power of Brazil are involved, the legislative, the executive, the judiciary. They are all involved in this scheme. And now we are debating, debate here in Brazil, if there's going to have a federal intervention here in Brasilia because of that.
So they're all involved in developing this land. This is just one instance of widespread abuse.
Yes, but it's only one aspect. There are other projects being done that in this moment here in Brasilia. We had not only this trouble with the Indian, but we had trouble with Afro-cults here, like Afro-cult religions like Candomblé and Umbanda, for instance. There were some monuments of them that were destroyed by evangelical people. Two houses of the Candomblé and Umbanda were destroyed by the Company of Land of Brasilia. They were destroyed, like, illegally. And what, in fact, is happening is, like, they are... Everything that's against, like, the idea of Indian, the idea of African culture, it's like somehow it reminds us like the idea of the past, because Brazil is like the modern architecture. Then it's like Brazil was built for that reason, to be a portrait, to be a mirror of development. Is a developed country for all over the globe, you know. And then the presence of the Indians and the Afro-cults, like, reminds, like, of the colonial past, of all the things that was not resolved at all, and still happening, and still living, coexisting with this modern architecture of Brasilia. But it's been, like, erased.
So nothing has changed now that the colonists have left.
No,
really?
Not at all. We are suffering with the social, because Brasilia was constructed. The architect of Brasilia, he's quite famous, Oscar Niemeyer. You might have heard about him. He was like a communist. Mm-hmm. He was from the communist party. That Brasilia had the idea of living in an inequality system, like the poor guy would live with the rich guy in the same area, then they will have no problem. But since the construction, that's not what's happening in the praxis, you know. It's totally different from the speech.
He promised that there would be more equality.
Hmm. Yes, the promise of equality, it's like, it's not happening. It's like, not at all. We are living here in Brasilia, like, we have places in Brasilia, like, neighborhoods that are equally in income to Sweden, Norway, and there are other places in Brasilia that are compared to places like Africa, African places, like African countries that are suffering with civil wars, that are suffering with AIDS and SIDA, you know? And then, like, it's a continental inequality that we're living just by here, like, it's very near, like, the social inequality. But here in Brazil, we have the urban plan, the plano piloto, we call pilot plan, which is like an area of apartheid area from the poor people. Like, that's what's happening in Brazil.
So there's a lot of wealth discrepancies and massive poverty.
And massive poverty. That's not only that. Like, we have, like, a problem with water. We don't have water to... Because we are under the main manancial of water. Here is the place of birth. Here is the cradle of the main manancial water of not only Brazil, but of manancial of water that goes to Uruguay, Argentina, and Paraguay. That it comes here. It's like, here is the place of birth. It's called Aguas Emendadas, and we are not protecting it.
Could you say a little bit of water? There's a large body of water. Is there a river that goes?
No, it's not a river. It's like a manantial. Like, here we have, from this manantial, it goes to different, like, to river plate in different areas. It goes to Amazon. It's like 5,000 kilometers of water that somehow grows here and goes to different regions of Brazil and goes to different regions of Argentina, it goes to Paraguay, it goes, like, we are talking about Mercosur now. It's like a discussion that we are facing in Brazil. It's like an amazing fact, like, here in this, like, the noble areas, like the areas where there are people with plenty of money, they waste water, like, in a quantity amazing. Like,
Water, does it flow? How does it flow to all the areas of Brazil? Is it rivers or is it aquifer? Is it underground?
It's underground.
Underground.
It's underground.
Okay.
It's like a water road somehow.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's a concern then about possibly a water shortage and an abuse of water.
Yeah.
Water hoarding.
Because no, there's no. In fact, like what we were saying, we had problems here in Brasilia with areas, like noble areas. All the houses, they have swimming pools. In Brasilia, like, you know, according to the Health Organization study, is the place where you waste more water. It's here in Brasilia, in the South Lake, which is a place for rich people.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other areas in Brasilia where they spend, like, much less water compared, I don't know, like 7 or 6
so what,
6 times less than these people that can have money, that can waste water.
Rafael, will you talk more about the Indian community on that land, Banal?
Bananal.
And
Bananal.
So the Bananal, when that community started, do they have any legal rights to that land? I guess that's the salient question. Or are they simply doing what human beings have been doing forever, living on the land?
Where they are living was because before the construction of Brasilia, these areas were occupied by farms. this area of the Bananal, it was a farm called Bananal, Bananal Farm.
Mm-hmm.
It was bought in 1955 it was bought by the state to be the first place where Brazilian would grow up. It was then, we are talking about where they are living now, it's the place where Brazil started.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the exact place where they are.
And Brasilia is the new capital.
Mm. In the capital. And then, since then, there were some studies.
Mm-hmm.
Some studies were done there. But what we are mentioning is like a matter of like saying that the urban Indians are not recognized yet in Brazil. Like, they feel that where the Indians go to the urban areas, they are not Indians anymore. They are beggars or they are workers. They are something, but not more. Because how these people can be Indians if they are not living in Amazon? If they are not, because we fantasize with this idea of Indians that they are living only in the Amazon or only.
Mm-hmm.
We have a stereotype of Indian.
It is a stereotype.
Indians, they are from the northeast of Brazil. Then the northeast of Brazil was the first place where the Portuguese came in.
Uh-huh.
There were a lot of mixture with black people, with Portuguese and Europeans. And since till the 19th century in the northeast of Brazil, they used to say that there were like no more Indians in Brazil uh-huh. northeast. Only in the 20th century they were recognized.
Mm-hmm.
That they were Indians because of some rituals, because for instance, these Indians, these Cunhos, they have they mm-hmm. kept their language. They have for
they
more
kept
than
their language.
Yeah,
great.
They kept their language. They are one of the only tribes in Brazil that kept their language because this process was really violent. Then they lost their idioms. They lost, and they have this. They are very proud of that.
Mm-hmm.
Then when they came to Brasilia, they kept all these things. Like here, Brasilia is like a place, like it's like a tribe.
Yes.
But when you go there, you see like this place is used not only for Indians, but for poor people. There are poor people living there
mm-hmm.
nearby. There are drug dealers. Where this place is like we have native vegetation. There are drug dealers who sell drugs there. They are like, it's like we have this idea that this area is only used for drugs.
Mm.
It's only used that these poor people are there, but they're homeless. And somehow the Indians are living where they are living. And they are mixed all in the same, you know,
so
in
it
the
sounds
same perspective.
Like they were taken from their land and they lost their traditions, the right to practice them.
Mm-hmm.
And was there a policy of assimilation? Or were there?
Since the Constitution of 1988, which is the last one of Brazil, this perspective of assimilation was deconstructed. It's not being used anymore. It's not being used as a term, as
Good.
A term of thought in the legal law. But in the when we see how the daily life of Brasilia, it has not been, it's like it's being it's still being used for them.
Yes.
Even in the National Foundation of
Just in
India,
name
which
only.
Which is in Brazilia, the National Foundation, they say, oh, these Indians, no, they don't need rights because they don't have land, they are not from here. Then we can't do anything about them. Just let them. They go to live under the bridge or something like this.
No, wasn't a center or an institution, a governmental branch created
for the
indigenous?
It's called FUNAI, which is National Foundation of Indians.
And is FUNAI. That not effective, or is it just what's going on with?
They FUNAI? Really know. It's like from 15 minutes or 20 minutes from FUNAI, where they live, where the Indians are living, is from like 20 minutes from FUNAI. The president of FUNAI went there once and said once, like, the president of FUNAI, the president of this National Foundation of Indians, he went to the Bananal to meet the Bananal and see their request. And he said, no, we are going to do something about it. It's like, it's amazing that we have an Indian tribe in the capital of Brazil. Then, but nothing has been done up to the moment. Like, we have a difficult situation here.
So they were given empty promises for aid, and they never got any.
They got any heaven.
Can you say a little bit about the land? Isn't it, I had spoken to you on the phone yesterday, and you said that it was truly sacred, and that for years the medicine people would go there, and I guess harvest the medicines there and perform many ceremonies.
Yeah, of course, because where they are located, it's located churches, it's the place where they're located, not only churches, but places for Islamic people, for people of different thoughts, of different religions.
Yes.
They were the first one to go there because these Indians, they had ritual that they need nature.
Yes,
then
they do.
Then they went to these places in order to worship their God, in order to practice their religions and to have contact with their gods, with their perspective of religion.
Yes.
He was the first one to go there. Then, years after years, like here, we have nowadays churches for Catholic people. We have spaces for people of different cults, Only they are not recognized. And they were the first one to get there.
Only the Indians are not recognized.
It's a place because many Indians go there because the capital is the place where many Indians come to request their laws to be respected and so on.
Yes.
Then many Indians go there, shamans, not only Brazilian Indians, but I have seen Indians from Chile, Peru, and other countries being there because the only place where their culture is still alive.
So what do you think, Rafael, needs to happen to help the Bananel remain as a green space, open space, and also to have home for the Indians?
How can we assist?
Yeah, I think it's like the first step to recognize the history of Brazil.
Yes.
Because we are going to complete 50 years in never in the history of Brazil, the last capitals, like I was telling you about, Salvador and Rio, they never had recognized an Indian community, and we can have in the 21st century an Indian community recognizing the capital of Brazil. This
That's
is
wonderful.
Historical fact. It's like
it
for
is.
The perspective.
And we the can, fact it, that well, so what? Many, so many other tribes throughout Latin America recognize that land too as truly sacred.
Yeah. And we have like an important ecosystem there, which should be preserved because this savanna I was mentioning, Cerrado, is like so diverse. It's like compared with the Amazon, it has like a rich biodiversity. Like it's responsible for a rich biodiversity. It's been destroyed. Like in Brazil, in 50 years, they have destroyed 57% of it in less than 50 years. Like we are, I think, in the history of the world, in the last capitals in Latin America, we are the capital who have destroyed in, I think, I don't know, the speed of it, like, it was really accelerated, and we haven't stopped it, like, since then, we haven't stopped, the nature has been destroyed, since then, they are constructing buildings, they are constructing everywhere here, the advertise of the governor, the vice governor of Brazilian, saying, here we are investing your money to construct something, like, in
your
this
tax
habitat.
Money.
If the what I think if this Indian community is recognized, is a way of saying like stop, we don't want anymore like the nature being destroyed in this way.
Yes.
We want to have an Indian land for people because that's a great thing. Like we are copying a model of development really old. We are really old. It's not used by any other country. It's used, but. It's really old-fashioned, like not rational countries doing like us, like destroying the last green area. If you go to Germany, if you go to Japan, if you go to other capitals of the world, you can see that they are trying to preserve the last thing they have.
Yeah.
In Brazil, no,
they don't have much left.
They don't have much left, and here we still have something, but we are somehow
rapidly
destroying
losing
it, like, so
it.
Fast, so fast, and
you're
I
witnessing
don't know,
like, it.
What?
You're witnessing it firsthand.
Yeah.
So I'm sure in your life you've seen it being destroyed.
Yeah, of course. It's like it's amazing. It's amazing how it's so where they are living is near the Congress, is near all the institutional powers of Brazil, is near Lula. And
oh, it's near the president. Jeez, and nothing is
done. He can go in city if he wants. Like,
so
he doesn't have to take a plane to go to Amazon, you know.
Mm-hmm. So what is happening politically? What are you guys doing
here in Brasilia?
Yeah.
Then this governor Arruda is involved in a scheme of with another deputy, not only deputy but business people. He's involved in many cases of corruption. He and his vice governor, the vice governor of Brazil, is Paulo Otávio. And yesterday, he resigned because there are three operations of the federal police against him. This businessman, the Paulo Otávio, and he's owner of radio programs. He's owner. He's like a billionaire here. And Arruda, he was recorded. He was. There are some tapes that were broadcast here. Like they were showing Arruda receiving money, plenty of money, not only him, but many deputies receiving money to approve projects of construction, of the construction sector, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They were filmed.
So it was bribery.
What?
He was bribing.
Yeah, of course.
Or being bribed, of course, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's like amazing. We have the images here. We have all these images. And it's like we are since the last year we are making many protests against him.
Mm-hmm.
Saying, for instance, he approved now a project that will organize the Brasilia for the next 10 years. And it's like this plan. He bought the deputies. He paid R$4,020 for each deputy to approve it. It's like if you see the map of Brazil with this project, it's all being fulfilled with buildings, with bridges, with roads, with everything that's going to be a good thing for Paulo Otávio for private interest. What we have here, we don't have it's not separate the private interest and the public interest.
So the officials have been bought off.
What?
Are you saying that the officials have been bribed as well to approve?
Yeah, they were bought.
They were bought.
All the institutional powers in Brazil are involved. The legislative, the judiciary, the executive.
Judiciary.
It goes even further. It goes to the federal instance, you know. It goes to federal places, to federal deputies.
Wow.
It's what's happening here in Brazil. It's something what's happening not only in Brazil but all over Brazil.
Uh-huh.
All the states are really corrupted. We have cases of corruption here in many states. Even Governor Lula there was a similar scheme of corruption similar to what's happening now in Brazil. It was divulged and nothing happened. Then it became like something. Naturalized people being stolen, people being robbed by these people it becomes something that we are saying, nothing is going to happen.
Yeah, I saw a film about that. Yeah. So
then,
it's a positive sign, I guess, that Arruda has been arrested.
He's still arrested for 15 days. He's arrested, and even in the he's in the federal police of Brazil. In Brasilia, and he's paying like protest. He's paying his public workers to go out on the streets, saying that Arruda is like the best governor of Brazil. That's not fair. That he is in jail. That he should be released. And these people are really violent. They are using violence against us.
Mm,
when they are on the street, they come in and they try to beat us up. They are really violent. They start screaming against us, and they have nothing really to protect him. Like the images are so clear, the scheme is so clear. The fact is, they are being paid. It was divulged here in the press. They are being paid to protest in favor of him, in favor of the government, in favor of corruption.
They're being paid to demonstrate in his favor, and they're really violent. Oh,
that's amazing. They're using public money to private interests. They're paying these people with public money. It's our money that is paying these people. It's quite amazing. It's quite amazing what's happening. It's not only here in Brasilia, but what I was mentioning here. Like, we have corruption somehow. It became part of the democracy of Brazil. The democracy here, as we see it, as it is in the daily life, it doesn't work without corruption. You have to pay a deputy, you have to pay the senator, you have to pay someone to approve some project. Then we are going to have the elections here this year. And it's like, they're quite terrible. Like, the candidates are really worse than ever. We are I don't know how to say this, but Brazil is like going, it's like a shame what's happening. It's like, we are this kind of politics, which is being managed here, which is being managed in Brazil, is so old and so, it makes so much damage. Not only the image of Brasilia, but of the whole country, because we are talking about the capital, you know.
I had thought when your president, who is indigenous, was voted in, that he would have more of an impact, but I guess there's so much corruption on many levels that it hasn't been possible. I was very hopeful many years ago when Lulu was elected.
Yeah, we had hope. Some people had hope with him.
Like Obama.
Because of his biography of life. But he had made like some agreements to be in power that's completely impossible to have to have changes in Brazil. The next one that is going to be to run for PT, the National Party of the Workers, she's a woman.
Oh.
It's nice that women goes more on the spot, but she's like the main chief of the main development project of Lula, which is called PAC, which is like translating. It's like a program to accelerate development. This project is the main corruption channel of the government. Mm. They are destroying Indian communities. They are destroying traditional communities. Now they are going to try to destroy the national park of Xingu in the Amazon, where the Indians are living to construct things. They are going they are going even to make genocide. Like, quite amazing what they're trying to do in the state of Rondônia, in the north of Brazil. They are going to construct a project going to flood all the area, and there are Indians living there that were not contact. They haven't been contact. We don't know nothing about them, and they are going to disappear just like this. It's like genocide what's happening. And we have this because we are saying, we are going to have the Olympic Games, we are going to have World Cup, then Brazil is going to be the first world, we are going to be so developed. In fact, the social inequality is huge. We have, like, Brazil is still a racist country.
Mm-hmm.
People hate black people hate Indians, people hate everything that it doesn't come to an image of development.
Yeah.
And we are going through, like, we are constructing these things just right now, and it's like it needs to be spread out, people, because we are going to have the Olympic Games and the World Cup, and they say, oh, that's so nice, the World Cup in Brazil, that's the place of soccer. That's
but
the
then
place
what
of
happens
summer.
To the people that are living there in the neighborhoods when they develop even more development for the World Cup? And
yeah, that's they are doing just like putting policemen.
More displacement.
They have been displaced over their land, poor people. They have been displaced over their land in order to, like here in Brazil, it's happening just right now. Here we have an area called Estrutural, which is like it was an invasion. Like, poor people went there and they started to construct this community. Then 300, 400 people was displaced from there. Because they had an international agreement that they would receive money in order to urbanize this area, then this area is going to be much more expensive. Then these poor people won't have money to pay the rent.
Mm-hmm.
Then they go to other areas, or they're going to live in the streets.
Yeah, it's happened here, but not to that extent, I'm sure, because the poverty level is so much greater there. Gentrification.
Yeah, it's like... What? I think it's a global phenomenon.
It is. So what can we do here to support you?
What I think support... is like, one thing that could be done, that here in Brazil, I'm going to be very sincere, we are a colonized country. We do everything you want, in what U.S. wants. Then these ideas, these things that I mentioned, it needs to be spread, it needs to go on the press, it needs to be debated in U.S., not only in U.S., but in these developed countries. Then it will come out to our country if it doesn't go this way, because the press is, the whole press is controlled
mm-hmm.
by this group. Then they censor all this thing I'm talking to you.
You
it
need
censor.
Probably international press too.
The
down
international
there,
press,
witnessing.
We have to tell it, like, go to ONU. We have to. We never have international laws talking about it. Then what is happening here? Like, it needs to be diverse. It needs to be spread all over the globe. Because it's an example for not only for the individually, for the Indian yeah. struggle, but for struggles all over the globe, for different
yes.
Indian communities, from different traditional communities.
Yeah, exactly. The traditional communities is happening all over the globe.
All over. And here we are trying to, we have contact with some people. I study anthropology, but here, I'm part of different groups, and we are divulging much more from indie media, you know, indie media.
I certainly do,
it
yes.
It was created in 1989 in Seattle.
Yes.
We have some people of indie media helping us, making video, radio broadcasts. Mm. Like, we are making our own press here.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I was part of a radio program, free radio, like just oh. like yours in Santa Cruz.
Oh,
yeah, in the universe, then we are trying to, we have to create our own communication, to try to expel it,
yeah.
to try to, because otherwise we are going to be hostage of these things for our entire life.
Mm-hmm.
And here the communications are so controlled in Brazil. For instance, the free radio here can't go for more than 1 kilometer. It's like nothing, like it doesn't. Anybody hear free radios here? Only by the internet. Only by the website.
The internet. Record your programs and then put them on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
we can play them here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, and there are many other free radios and community stations,
awesome.
Too.
Like, we have to construct the
yes.
internet.
It's...
Because I have some friend of mine who live in the U.S., a friend of mine, Rossi Polanco.
I know Rossi. She was...
Yeah,
I interviewed
her.
She was great.
And I was talking to her like 3 years ago when I went to Bolivia. I met her, and I was talking about it like 3 years ago in Bolivia. Everywhere mm-hmm. I go, I talk about it, like trying to make contacts, trying to create this net. To because if we I can't do it all on my own.
No,
I need more people.
But you certainly do an awful lot, and thank you.
Yeah. Somehow, I'm not the only one. There are some people here. Doing the same. We are not so many, but we are a few people trying to think about it, trying to have a clue of what to do here. We don't have like a manual what to do. We are trying to do. We are doing it like with many errors. We are doing it on ourselves, because it's like do it yourself, like the funding thing.
I really have to applaud you. And in Brazil too, you still have land.
Mm-hmm.
And you
yeah.
still have some tribes living on the land.
But all this land is being occupied by banks, it's being bought by different, yeah. Amazon, the different places are being occupied now, as a matter of fact.
So the Amazon is being rapidly destroyed and they're building large cities?
Not all in the Amazon. I think the Cerrado is like Amazon, but not being divulged.
Oh,
like I was telling you about, like, all the ecosystem here in Brazil is going the same direction, but Cerrado is like we have statistics that it will not go much longer, because they are planting transgenic food here, They are creating cattle. They are destroying it, like to do different things. It's not going to last. And we have this idea ecosystem that one system needs the other. Like the Amazon needs the Cerrado. Right. The Cerrado needs the other ecosystem. It's all connected. We don't have this point of view. We think, the Amazon, but we don't relate it anymore. Like, we don't see it like something in relation to other ecosystems, with people, with animals, with plants,
yes,
with biodiversity, social biodiversity.
Social biodiversity, well said.
Yeah. And you're going to make a question?
I was going to ask you some more about the traditions of the people and what they bring to the Brazilians, the traditions that continue, and the diversity of plants and the spirit of the plants and those ceremonies.
Yeah.
If they're lost, the nation loses so much.
Then
how to communicate that?
This group that I'm talking about, the Funios. Funios, they're a group from the northeast of Brazil. They have closed rituals. They have plants of powers that it's not allowed white people to enter in these rituals. It's only for the Indians. It's a closed ritual because they have their own language. They have their own spiritual aspect which is connected. It's not separate. Like the idea that we separate human beings and nature. It's all connected, what's happening in nature, what's happening with human beings.
Yes.
And they have this, they are living here, but now they have different plants, and they use it for medicine.
Yes.
They have traditional plants, they have dead plants, different things, because they don't have much money there, so they have to plant. And where they are living, and it can be considered as a whole in Brazil, where the Indians are living, their place are being preserved.
And they're self-sufficient. That's true sustainability. And if they lose that, they have to go into the cities.
Traditional communities are leaving, their places are being cultivated. Their places are not being destroyed because they have... it's not something of... We have, like, in Brazil, not only the Indians, but different traditional communities. We have Quilombos, which are the communities of descendants of slaves. Quilombolas, we say here, like, which like the palenques, or you have other terms in Latin America. But they have these communities, where they are living, they are suffering with the land issue, because other land are being displaced, because they are constructing things on their land, they are exploiting natural resources, and then these people are being... In Brazil, I think this thing is important for you. In the Lula government, it was the time when the indigenous leaders were more killed.
Oh, my.
And it's all involved with wood conflict, with natural resources conflict.
Oh.
I don't like the idea of natural resources because it reminds us of something. Resource is something like an economic good. But the way...
A live system as opposed to...
Yeah.
So more are being killed.
It's more being killed.
Because,
like,
again, I always go back to this. There's a conflict of values, development versus preserving the land and a whole way of life.
Yeah, of course.
That is really that is self-sustaining.
They are not only being killed, they are killing themselves.
They are killing themselves?
They are committing suicide. Like the Guaranis, they are committing suicide because they have this link with the land. They have their beliefs. And the land is like an important structure of their beliefs. When they are taken out of their land, they are committing suicide here. Like the Guarani situation is quite horrible here in Brazil. Not only Brazil, but the Guaranis. This is the thing, like, we have to think when we think about Brazil. Because these Indians, they are in the boundaries, in the frontiers of different countries. We have frontiers of Venezuela. There's Indians in Venezuela, in Colombia, in Paraguay, in Bolivia. And when we talk about Latin America, we only talk about commercial trades, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the Indians is a way of seeing the Latin America, you know, how we are united somehow. by this community, by these pueblos, I don't know how to say it, by these people, how we are somehow united with different places of Latin America, because Brazil, we are the only country who speaks Portuguese.
Mm-hmm.
And not only Portuguese, because we have 108 indigenous languages here in Brazil, and other languages also. And we have these people, these groups, ethnical groups, are the link for other places, for other regions, for other countries. You know?
Mm-hmm.
They are really important, but they are seen as a national threat, because where they live in the frontiers, we had a case here just 1 year ago, last year, of the Raposa Serra do Sol. Have you heard about this?
No.
You have 1 minute remaining.
Oh, we're going to have to wrap it up. My phone card is at its end here. I guess it's more expensive to call Brazil than it is locally. It must be about 10 cents. Well, I am so sorry. I didn't realize that. This has never happened before. Rafael, what are some websites that our listeners can go to?
Or places to send donations.
That's, I think if you want, you can go to Santuário dos Pajés. I'm going to write it. I'm going to translate it. Santuário dos Pajés, S-A-N-T-U-A-R-I-O, which we say Santuário.
All right.
Santuário.
Dos Pajés, D-O-S.
Yes.
P-A. Rota, how do you say in
H?
I'm talking about J?
H?
A? E-S. E-S.
And you know what?
Please
you
enter the number you wish to dial.
You sent me information, so when we hang up, I'll go online and relay the information. Rafael?
I think he's gone.
Oh, we've lost him. Boy, those international phone cards are very expensive and have very little.
You have dialed
time.
An invalid number.
Shh. There, that's over.
Don't talk to
us. Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, that sounds...
How abrupt. Well, I'm going to go online right now and see what I can get. So hopefully we can have him on again, and I'll try calling him back. I don't have any other phone cards.
Yeah, there must be something to get.
Let's
off that.
Let's see what
website.
I can get here.
Santuario dos Pajes?
In the meantime, let's see if I can put on an Amazon Ensemble.
There you go. That would be
good. Let's see what we can get. Then I'll get some more information for you. Let's see what we can get here. Oh, something's coming on. Here we go. We'll be back. Thank you. Hi, this is Janae again, and I did find the information. If you want to learn more about Raphael's situation, the situation in Brazil and the land close to Brasilia that's endangered, and it's www.santuariodospages.org. Again, www.santuariodospages. And there is an article in magazine NACLA. That's NACLA.org. And then /node/5283. Now we have to end abruptly, and thank you for listening. It's Free Radio Santa Cruz, and this was Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the heartland of Santa Cruz. And now, unfortunately, I could not get Palestinian news. Their system is down. But I do have free speech coming right up.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, February 25th, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, President Obama meets with lawmakers in a summit on healthcare reform. India and Pakistan resume peace.